Technicians of Spaceship Earth, welcome to Hawk Binge, your ultimate auditory expedition into the enigmatic cosmos that is the Hawkwind discography, one album at a time. In the company, as always, of an established fan, which is me, and your favourite first-time listener, which is, of course, Matt. Hello, Matt.
Good evening.
Yes, good evening. Indeed, good evening. How the devil are you?
I'm getting into the Berlin Spring, which is basically, it rolls a dice and decides what weather it's going to be. Today, it's literally bounced between like 15 degrees and sunny, and then 10 degrees and raining within half an hour of itself. So I have no idea what's going on, but at least it's not getting dark at 4 p.m. anymore. So no, I'm in a good mood.
Excellent. That will be music to the ears of all listeners. Will he still be in a good mood in a couple of hours' time? We shall see. Despite the fact you're in a good mood, we have to start this episode on a slightly more somber note, unfortunately, as news emerged of the passing of Mick Slattery, who you won't have heard much of or about because actually he wasn't on the first Hawkwind album. But he is a founder member of the band. He was in the famous Cure, which I think he was in with Dave Brock before Hawkwind formed. And there are demos of Hawkwind Zoo, which is what it was called again before they kind of went with Hawkwind. And on the streaming version, on the CD version of the first album, there are bonus tracks. Bring It On Home, The Willie Dixon Number, Hurry On Sundown, Kiss of the Velvet Whip, and Cymbeline, which is another cover, which all feature Mick Slattery on the lead guitar. So he is very much a founder of this thing that has left us such this massive legacy of music to explore. So RIP Mick, very sad to hear of that. He died age 77 after a short illness. What I think was quite gratifying was that that was picked up by quite a lot of the music press. There were quite a lot of nice things that were said, a nice response from Hawkwind themselves, as you would expect. So farewell, Mick, and thanks for the legacy that you've left us with. A couple of new things to bring to your attention and everybody else's. New releases that we wouldn't normally mention, but they spark something in me. One is Geobia, a favorite of Hawk Binge Sessions playlist. They have a new album coming out called Acid Disorder. That comes out in about a month's time. And Mythic Sunship, who we also featured, had an album out at the tail end of last year. Reason I'm kind of mentioning those is, A, they were very popular on the Hawkbinge Sessions playlists, but also when we featured them on the playlists, it was with their then new album. So we've now been going long enough, Matt, for bands whose new albums we featured on the Sessions playlist to have recorded follow-ups, and that felt quite weird.
Yeah, I guess we have been going for some time now. Well, technically, we've now been going on for 2 decades.
Yes, exactly. It does feel like that, doesn't it? And this, of course, is the last one of the 1980s. This is the end of season 2, apart from the very special wrap-up that we have plans to record. So, Matt, I've brought in Geobia and Mythic Sunship, neither of which is my pick for this episode in terms of turntable picks. I'm sure you've been listening to some interesting stuff. What would be your first pick?
My first pick is by an artist called Flako, F-L-A-K-O. He is well known for doing, I don't want to call it dubstep, but it's that very low bassy kind of music that you'll hear in certain clubs or banged out of 4x4s down the LA Strip. And I can be partial to some of that sometimes, but he also is very good at producing more ambient pieces. And I picked up his album Nature Boy, and while it has plenty of tracks that are ready to shake the foundations, I wanted to share a track which I thought was more of an olive branch between some of the things that I listen to and this community, because I don't want to come in and necessarily pollute the playlists with things that I like in that style. I have to rein in some of the things that I enjoy. But there's a track on his album Nature Boy called Gellis, and it's one of those tracks that kind of reminded me a little bit of some of the things on this album, which are just very sweet, rhythmic, repetitive, but feel like good spring tracks. As the days start to get lighter and you start to feel some of the warmth of the sun, it's the kind of track that you can put on while you walk around and just feel good about life. I'm sure it's all completely synthesized, but it sounds more like a little orchestra, but it has these really nice synthy flows with a very long attack. So it's almost that feeling where it almost sounds reverse. And there's just something very nice about that when you add those kind of envelopes to more instrumental feelings, because it feels familiar and organic, yet somehow synthesized. And yeah, it just feels like dreamy and blissful and slightly out of focus. And yeah, it just feels like the kind of thing that you could lay on a park to. So I wanted to share that nice bit of vibe with the people who listen to the playlist.
That's interesting, because I've got a kind of a similar story, really. I'm sure it's vastly different musically, but actually in terms of vibe and mood, we've gone in very similar directions. As you know, I have a fondness for some jazz, not a huge aficionado or anything, but I have some jazz. But it's all quite old. It's all, you know, Miles Davis, Wayne Shorter, Bill Evans, Ornette Coleman, all this kinds of thing. And I wondered about contemporary jazz artists. It's still a thriving scene, but I've no idea where you even start. It's like someone coming up to you and going, I quite like rock music. Who should I listen to? I was chatting to a friend and he said, you should listen to Matthew Halsall, which is what I then did. He's a Manchester-based trumpet player, but he's just huge in the music scene over there. He's got his own label, Gondwana Records, done quite a lot of albums. And it's really that beautiful, sunny, relaxed vibe. He's a trumpet player, but it's very mood-oriented. It's really chilled out. Really like it. He had an album out in 2022, so it's pretty new, called Changing Earth. And the track I've chosen is called Positive Activity, which has a lovely bass line to introduce it. But really, the album and his albums generally are just things that you can put on and boost the mood that you're in for whatever you're doing at the time. So both of us have gone for quite sunny, mood-enhancing music to expand our horizons with. Anything else from your side, Matt?
Anyone who listens to this podcast for more than a second will probably have figured out that I'm quite the Gorillaz fan. I think I've definitely mentioned them several times when I've tried to talk about some references and things that I personally enjoy. And kind of out of nowhere, they dropped a new album called Cracker Island, which dropped maybe a month or so ago. And I thought that they were kind of done, to be honest. Their last real album, I would argue, was the Now Now, which came out in 2018, to less acclaim than some of their other big albums like Demon Days. They then made a little thing called Song Machine Season 1, which was a lot of collaborations. And again, was seen as a little bit of a, they're not quite sure what the band is up to, and then it seemed to go dormant. But almost a year ago, I guess, they started doing this very slow boil for fans. They started to make this whole story where the band members had been indoctrinated into a cult, and they made like a website where you could join in, and all this kind of like live blogging and animations and a little videos started to then turn into music videos, which turned into this album. And I would say it's put them back on top. I think the album is really, really good. It's a great return to form for them. And, you know, while I could probably pick some Stone Cold classics from their extensive and fantastic discography, I wanted to grab something from them right now and put this into the playlist to show that they're back and as good as ever. So I'll be adding the track Silent Running. That album is Cracker Island. I think it's really, really good. I think Silent Running, again, is one of those tracks which balance the more electro pop with their more, you know, established like indie credentials in a really nice way. And I just don't think anyone really sounds like them. And I've been really, really enjoying that again with a springy, summertimey vibe.
Outstanding. Well, my second pick, again, is somewhat radically different from the first. And all of our picks actually are about as diverse as the entire playlists, I think, at this point. So it's Kate Bush. And Kate Bush obviously came back quite heavily into the public consciousness in recent times with Running Up That Hill was part of Stranger Things and did very well. But that album is not really the album that I gravitate towards with Kate Bush. I've got several Kate Bush albums, would always acknowledge the genius and the landmark artist that she is without ever having been like a hardcore fan. I'm a bit like that with David Bowie, to be honest. Like, I don't have all the David Bowie albums, but you'd always acknowledge what an incredible artist he was. Kate Bush is like that for me. But I saw on YouTube on the way home from London one day when I was just kind of looking for something to watch was an interview as part of a podcast between a woman who's something to do with a national vinyl archive or something with Stephen Wilson. And they were discussing The Dreaming from 1982, which is the first one that she did entirely on her own. She plays pretty much everything on a Fairlight synthesizer sampler. It is wildly experimental. And the music is extraordinary across the whole thing. And it is at that time when Gabriel was doing his really experimental stuff with world music. And again, he was into the Fairlight at the same time. The track I've gone with is the last track on the album called Get Out of My House, which even features Kate Bush shouting an impression of Eeyore the donkey, such as its weirdness. And it's out there. And I love that just exploratory side of things much more than I tend to like the things that ended up being famous and doing well in the charts. And The Dreaming isn't one I don't think was a huge chart success. It probably did pretty well given who she was, but it's not the one people go back to and remember, but it is the one that I've really enjoyed listening to. So four pretty diverse picks, and they will be in the Volume 5 Hawkbeam Sessions playlist. There's some interesting stuff on there.
And looking forward to starting Volume 6 in the near future.
Exactly. We will be publishing Volume 5 and putting it out there on the socials in the coming weeks. Matt, we've heard from a few people in the past few weeks, have we not?
Yeah, we have. Thanks to everyone who listened to the much more chaotic YouTube version of the last podcast. I think it's nice when you can see us talking, you know, there's a little bit more organicness, but hopefully anyone who looks at that and then also listen to the podcast can see why it takes so long to get these out, because I painstakingly go through and try to destroy every but story that goes nowhere or thing which pulls us too far away from the main thread. So you can see that the YouTube version is 2.5 hours long, and the podcast was, I think, 120. So there's 1 hour and 10 of stuff which I decided was not A class material. But anyone who wants to see the difference between the real thing and the podcast can go and check that out. But some people left some nice words there, which is awesome. Very nice to see some of the regular people dropping in that say that they're keeping up, which is very, very cool. And we had some nice emails from newer listeners, which was really cool, Andy. Mr. Tom Welsh reached out to say, I wanted to drop you an email to say how much I'm enjoying your podcast, which is very nice of you, Tom. Thank you very much. Tom then went on to say, your podcast, and I guess others on the Deep Dive Network, has been very instructive for me in reviving the discipline of playing an album from start to finish again and again, reflecting on what it brings up for me emotionally and musically, and in conjunction with the sleeve art, context of other contemporary albums, etc. I had noticed myself drifting into playlists and randomly sequenced tracks. Hawk Binge has helped me to return to the album as a discrete and self-contained form, which I think is really nice. I think that's a massive win for Tom, and I think it's a great achievement for anyone to really start to reevaluate what it means to put an album together, because I'm certainly still guilty of occasionally just putting on whatever the hell Apple Music's made for me while I'm not really paying attention. And I think sometimes the ubiquity of music means that we don't treat it with maybe the respect that we should, and, you know, culture changes and music is very much a soundtrack for more things, I would say, compared to maybe like back in the day when you'd have to put on headphones or put something on and find out what you wanted. Now pretty much everything plays music in your house somehow, right? Tom's not the only person who's mentioned that they've really stopped and listened to the album, and to be able to refocus your mind and really get into an hour or so of properly selected music and really get into why it was made and how it was made and why it was selected, and being able to pull all these things out of it, I think is a great experience to have. And I'm glad that we've been able to help retain it in some small way through how we work and how we encourage people to also listen to the podcast with us.
I couldn't agree more. Tom's email really does make me smile. We'd do this anyway, even if we were the only two people who then listened to it. But comments like that, it's amazing to hear. And thanks for sharing that with us, Tom.
Moving on, Nick from Church of Hawkwind Artwork fame thanked us for talking about his work. So I guess he's been catching up and finally got to himself. So hi, Nick, whenever you get to this one. One thing he mentioned in his mail was that at times as a Hawkwind fan, I get Hawkwinded out and have to stop listening to the band for a while. But as soon as I know there's a new episode of Hawk Binge available, then he's back in. He mentioned that the Live Chronicles episode just dragged him back from a Welsh folk music binge. So that's quite a hard turn.
That's a different podcast altogether, isn't it?
Yes, I'm glad he was able to drag himself back from that. He also said that another really enjoyable aspect of Hawk Binge is that shared enthusiasm which follows us Hawkwind fans to disagree so much without it being any kind of issue. In a world where people are tearing each other apart on Twitter and Facebook about the sort of trivial nonsense, it's really refreshing to hear people expressing contrary opinions about music in such a respectful and humorous manner. This was even more obvious when you had Ian Abrams in from the Live Chronicles episode, which I completely agree with. I think it's nice that it can be a way of exchanging information, and especially someone like Ian, who's such an intelligent musical commentator anyway.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because when we started doing this, I was acutely aware that other than a bunch of albums, mostly in the 1970s, there are different opinions on all of these records. And when you look at Twitter in particular, which, let's face it, can be a bit of a cesspit, and you see discussions break out around different bands and different music, it does descend into the traditional comment section. And I hoped that that wouldn't be the case with us, and it hasn't been, basically. And I think it shows that this Hawkwind community are a very inclusive and forgiving bunch, particularly given some of the sacred cows that you've slain over the past couple of years. And yet we're all still friends. The family is still together. So that's been really good to experience, actually.
Yeah, I mean, even Job still talks to me, even though I repeatedly just try and annoy him now about the Salt and Battery. It's like one of my favorite things to do now.
Does he still talk to Ian Abrams? Because Ian came out as a very surprising ally for you on the Salt and Battery.
I know, I was surprised and felt vindicated and happy. But then he also said I was an idiot for not liking Moonglum. So, you know, we'll call it a draw, I guess. One interesting bit of information we got, Andy, on the email was from Steam Abacus, who emailed us to talk about the removal of the spoken pieces on the last album. He said that the removal of Michael Moorcock's spoken pieces, which were reinstated on the Atom Henge reissue, was because of the deal signed with GWR Records to release the album. Mike had a previous with the owner of GWR, owned money, I presume, and refused to allow his sections to be on the album, so they had to be edited out. As I'd been at one of the London shows with Mike guesting, this was another disappointing aspect of this not being quite the flagship live album we were all expecting. He did finish by saying, for all its flaws, though, this is still the album with Dreaming City and, of course, Moonglum, both memorable highlights of the live gig. Like most fans, I knew I was bemused that these didn't make the album. This isn't the first time that we've heard them have strange beef with people in the industry. And I guess this time, unfortunately, it was the fans that missed out by someone deciding to just be quite petty and just remove this person's spoken word piece when there was really no need for it. But that is the industry. Bouncing through, Ian Griffiths sent us a mail to say in the classic GWR LC version, there's no duplication of the usurped his throne speech. So it's a bit weird hearing that it is on some versions. I think it's also then weird that that is the version which is on all the streaming sites, because if there is one which is correct, why is that not the one that I can get hold of? I have no idea, but unfortunately, multiple usurpations is the way that I experienced that record, and I'll have to try and find the proper version at some point and listen to it as it was actually intended to be heard. Ian also said, one of my favourite bits is at the end of Zarazini when the audience is silent, drinking in the song, where there's someone from the band, presumably Dave, shouting, "Come on, crowd," to rouse them out of their contemplations, never fails to raise a smile. William Fife messaged us just to confirm where the Magni lyrics actually come from, because we were talking to Ian in our last podcast about that, because Magni reared its mystical head once more. And he says that the Magni lyrics, which I've always found to be intriguing, are excerpts from the Hymn of Apollo by Percy Shelley from verse 3, I think, and is the history of Prince. And this looks like Sluggo Bill or the Invisible Knight. So I'm going to say it's the Invisible Knight, and that is where Magni comes from. So very useful to just get that now with a line drawn under it. And I promise I will try and remember that in case Magnu ever makes another reappearance in the next 2 decades.
Which it probably will.
No, exactly. You're not going to let a classic like that just go to pasture, are you, if you're Hawkwind?
Hell no.
All right. Andy Smale said, I thought I was the only one who thought a Salt and Battery was pointless dirge.
Harsh. Harsh.
I know. He says it's really pedestrian and doesn't start the album well. And he said a whole bunch of other cool stuff, but that's the bit that I've decided to include. And Wayne Jeffrey sent us a huge email, which was really interesting to go through. But one of the things that I thought was really interesting is that he said, regarding Master of the Universe, I'm with Andy. I absolutely love this version, and I don't care what the 70s snobs say, which I thought was fun. He said, I'm kind of surprised nobody referenced the Space Ritual version for comparison, though, as it's so much heavier than the original and has guitar solo too, albeit by Brock. In fact, despite being a massive Lloyd Langton fan, I'd cite the Space Ritual version as the best ever, but this one would definitely be a close second. He also says, I agree with Andy also regarding Assault and Battery, although it's a very different vibe from the original version. I can appreciate it in its own right. Night as a separate entity. And I think those were two of the tracks where we said they'd really been brought up to a speed and intensity to fit in with the current track listings. And they are very different from the originals and yet somehow seem to slot really nicely into this as pumped up versions. And I think that both of those tracks, the originals, I was a bit like, they're fine, but they're lacking something. And it turns out that what I feel like they were lacking was a band to just come in and give them a bit more grit and speed and go crazy with them. So yeah, I'm really glad they did.
Absolutely. And I would also point out that there are lots of other people who write at length about how they agree with me on various things as well, but we choose not to read those ones out for some reason. There's a lot of banter on Twitter, and that's brilliant to read. There's so much of it, actually, that picking one or two out has become an impossible task. But thank you to everyone who corresponds with us through Twitter and also the various Facebook groups where I now fairly liberally put things, you know, our new episodes and when we do scans of booklets and programs. And we did one, of course, with Black Sword. Recently, someone was talking about, I think, Earth Ritual, and we put the program for that up, and people respond really well to it. It's nice to make these things available for people who remember them but don't have them. So shout outs to everyone who's commented or mentioned us on Facebook or Twitter. And particular thanks to those people who retweet us, because that is yet another way of just maybe bringing people in who don't know that we exist. So thank you so much for all of that. And with that, Matt, it is time to jump in the time machine and wend our way back to the heady heights of 1988. So 1988, Matt, it is 3 years since Chronicle of the Black Sword, but we don't really need to do much in the way of catching up because, of course, we did Live Chronicles and Hawkwind have had a merry old time touring Black Sword in that 3 years. And there isn't the signature massive global event such as Live Aid that fills that void. So let's look at some albums that came out in 1988. And this should do a good job of rooting our consciousness back into the era of the Xenon Codex. Blow Up Your Video by AC/DC comes out in 1988. And I'm pretty sure I saw them on that tour. Megadeth, So Far, So Good, So What? The Fall have two albums out this year, The Friends Experiment and I Am Curious Orange. So they were going at full speed. Talking Heads, Naked. King's X have their debut album, Out of the Silent Planet, which is a brilliant album. There are a few good debuts this year, including Soundgarden, Ultra Mega OK, comes out this year as well. Iron Maiden, Seventh Son of a Seventh Son, which is one of the ones that I like, and they headlined Donington Monsters of Rock, and I was there. Living Colour, another debut album, Vivid, absolutely brilliant. And Lemmy was something of a fan of Living Colour, if I remember correctly. Prince, Love Sexy came out this year. Queensryche, Operation Mindcrime, I remember that being absolutely huge. Van Halen had OU812 out this year, which was their era of using really cheesy puns for some of their fairly cheesy Sammy Hagar-driven albums. Jimmy Page had an album called Outrider out this year, and I saw him do that live as well. And we have been waiting since 1988 for Jimmy Page to follow that up. I suspect he won't. Robert Palmer, Heavy Nova, that was enormous this year. Public Enemy, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, which featured such tracks as Bring the Noise. So a huge, huge album and one of my massive favourites. And obviously, very similar, Kylie Minogue, Kylie, comes out this year, which I assume is her debut album. And on the same note, Slayer South of Heaven, which is one of my preferred Slayer albums. The monstrous Straight Outta Compton by NWA is 1988. So you're kind of really getting a feel for what's going on. It's almost Stock Aitken, Waterman, thrash metal and rap. New Kids on the Block, Keeping the Standards High, Hanging Tough. Fishbone, don't know if you've heard of Fishbone, but if you haven't, check them out. Really good band, Truth and Soul. Ozzy Osbourne, No Rest for the Wicked, comes out this year, which is, I think, the first album that has Zakk Wylde playing the guitar. Billy Bragg, who my brother was very fond of in the 1980s, always feels to me like being symptomatic of Thatcherite Britain in his very kind of Labour socialist oriented music that I still think he's doing now and did enjoy his stuff. Workers' Playtime comes out this year. Frank Zappa, Broadway the Hard Way. And I saw this tour, which I was enormously happy to have seen, because of course he didn't last too much longer than this. Brilliant album. Pet Shop Boys, Introspective. The Traveling Wilburys, who I didn't really like, but it had Bob Dylan and George Harrison and a bunch of other people on it. REM came out with Green this year. Duran Duran, Big Thing. Pink Floyd released The Delicate Sound of Thunder, the live album. And Mike and the Mechanics released The Living Years, which I hated. And I always think that the various Genesis reformations over the years have done at least the service of being barriers in the way of more Mike and Mechanics albums. So the albums do a good job of rooting us in 1988, but the singles, I think, even more so, because nothing puts you back into an era like knowing what the hit singles were. So here's a few of those. Some of them were released in 87, but really became hits in 88, by the way. George Michael, Faith. How about Never Gonna Give You Up by Rick Astley? Yes, this is the year of Never Gonna Give You Up. Sweet Child of Mine by Guns N' Roses. I Should Be So Lucky, Kylie Minogue. In Excess, Have Need You Tonight. One Moment in Time, Whitney Houston. A Groovy Kind of Love, Phil Collins. He was everywhere. Could Have Been by Tiffany. Dirty Diana, Michael Jackson. Belinda Carlisle, This Was the Year of Heaven Is a Place on Earth. Bobby McFerrin, Don't Worry, Be Happy. That global crime against whistling emerges in this year, which I can't forgive, because one of my first jobs in digital media in a small company, when this would come on, five or six people would all start whistling. And it would grate on my nerves to the extent that I would have to leave the room. So Bobby McFerrin, thank you for that. Salt and Pepper, Push It. Terence Trent D'Arby, God, who remembers him? Sign Your Name. Red Red Wine by UB40, I remember that. Always On My Mind by Pet Shop Boys. Get Out of My Dreams, Get Into My Car by Billy Ocean. China in Your Hand to Pow, A Little Respect by Erasure. And also, this is the year of 500 Miles by The Proclaimers. So I don't know what else to do if you're not firmly entrenched in 1988 by this time. One very somber note is that 1988 is the year that we saw the last of Robert Calvert, who died in August of that year after the Xenon Codex was released and toured and everything else. But a sad note, and given how much we all enjoyed those Robert Calvert era Hawkwind albums in the 1970s, and they were certainly some of the most popular ones that we covered. And Matt, I know that you're particularly fond of Calvert's lyric writing. Mm. We thought we would just note that. So that is 1988. The band that goes into the studio in 1988 is the same one that toured Chronicle of the Black Sword. They've been together since recording Chronicle of the Black Sword. That is Dave Brock, Alan Davey on the bass, Danny Thompson on the drums, Hugh Lloyd Langton on the guitars, and Harvey Bainbridge on the keyboards. This album was released on the 25th of April, but it was recorded in February and March 1988, which means it was recorded extremely fast. And here is a bit of the story of that as we delve into the saga of Hawkwind by Carol Clark. And this is Alan Davey. We had about 3 weeks to do the album. We'd had a phone call from Douglas and Higgy, who tour managed Hawkwind at the time. All of a sudden, we've got a tour booked, and we've got to get an album ready to go in 3 weeks. Oh, Christ. We all went to this place in Bournemouth with our pieces of music and did them really quick. It's the biggest rush job I've ever done with Hawkwind. It reflects the whole mood in the studio at the time. We all went mad. After a week, we had to move to a studio in Monmouthshire, Loco Studios, in Carlaron, because Bournemouth wasn't suitable for some of the things. The engineer in Wales was a keyboard player who'd been with the Bay City Rollers. That's extraordinary, by the way. We were working from 12 noon till 12 midnight every day and sleeping in the studio. We had to get it finished because this tour had been booked. Guy Bidmead was producing it. He'd done stuff for Whitesnake and Motorhead. He was a nice enough guy, but he just sat there and smoked his fags. He didn't really put much input in. We had much stranger ideas than other people do, and he got lost. He still got paid, of course. It goes on to say, Alan remains proud of the album, despite the fact that it was recorded so quickly, he says. It seemed to be a very popular one. I liked it. There's some really good stuff on it, and it's not bad for 3 weeks. Dave Brock agrees. I thought it was quite a successful album, and the tour we did to promote it, The Mad Professor's Laboratory Tour was quite successful too. And we will delve slightly into The Mad Professor's Laboratory Tour a little bit later. Guy Bidmead, as Alan pointed out, had produced Motörhead. He produced Rock and Roll by Motörhead in 1987, which actually is an album I'm really fond of, and saw them play. So 3 weeks, start to finish, that is a pretty lightning fast bit of recording. And funnily enough, they didn't get the album out in time for the tour. The album comes out with about 3 dates on the tour left to play. And I realized that the show that I saw on that tour was before the album came out. So it all seems quite weird. It was on the charts for only 2 weeks and it peaked at number 79, but then Chronicle of the Black Sword peaked at number 65, and that's considered to be, you know, a successful album. So they're not really doing anything on the charts anymore, but that doesn't seem to be necessarily reflective of how people think about the albums. But it is fair to say, I think, that Xenon Codex is rather recorded in the shadow of Black Sword, which does cast quite an enormous shadow. Now, on this album, Dave Brock uses lyrics written by someone outside of the band, a man called Roger Neville Neal. He writes the lyrics to two of the songs on the album, The War I Survived and Heads. And I looked to see if I could find out about Roger Neville Neal. He is a Hawkwind fan, and I found him, of all places, on LinkedIn, which is not really what I expected. I thought I'd find some music paper writing about him or something. But there he is on LinkedIn, lyricist, poet, author. He has written some lyrics for quite a lot of different people, most recently for Don Falcone on a concept album with his band Spirits Burning. So he's still pretty active and doing a lot of stuff, Roger Neville Neal, and we will hear more of his wisdom later. Now, Matt, I don't know if you're wondering about the title of this album, The Xenon Codex.
Certainly was.
So was I, which is funny because I didn't at the time at all. But this time I remember Xenon, but I'll call it Xenon. When I was at school, xenon was one of the 5 noble gases, as they were called, the inert gases that don't react with anything, the others being helium, argon, krypton, and neon. Xenon definitely has the coolest name of those, given that krypton was stolen by the creators of Superman.
I would argue that neon is probably the most famous, though.
Neon is the most famous, but therefore also kind of a bit boring, because, you know, everyone's included the term neon lights in lyrics somewhere down the line, including this very album, in fact. So I did a bit more digging and I came across a website called TripSitter, in which there is an article titled Tripping on Xenon with this byline. This rare elemental gas produced at the center of merging neutron stars is one of the most powerful yet short-lived psychedelics known. And at that point, it's absolutely no surprise that this is a Hawkwind album title. In fact, how could it be anything other than a Hawkwind album title?
Given the fact that they only did this in 3 weeks, the fact it's a short-lived psychedelic is probably more poignant than even maybe they thought.
It's quite the most remarkably fitting Hawkwind album title for some considerable time, really. And on that note, Matt, let us dive into the album and the music itself. What is your hot take on the Xenon Codex?
When I saw the name of the album, I was worried that Hawkwind had drifted into that kind of nonsense area of sci-fi that we'd talked about before by just saying strange words counts as feeling futuristic and spacey instead of taking things we know about and putting them in new situations. But fortunately, after listening to this, it's less Angel Voices and much more Spirit of the Age, which was pleasing to discover. And now, as you've enlightened me about, the Xenon Codex makes sense by the idea of being both speedy and spacey at the same time. It is very poignant. I had no idea that it was made so quickly. For me, it certainly doesn't sound like it. In fact, the risk of sounding biased, the album has gone back to a lot more of what I enjoy about Hawkwind compared to things like Chronicle of the Black Sword, which was fine, but was verging on going into that fandom-y fantasy stuff, which I can kind of take or leave some of it, but I much like the sense of playfulness and experimentation and not being overly encumbered by people's stories, which is when I tend to prefer Hawkwind personally. Maybe they did that because they only had 3 weeks to do it. Maybe they went back to some of the things that they knew they could knock out. That said, there's definitely some experimentation in here, which is cool. But certainly for me, it's gone back to a little bit more of that familiarity. And for me, it felt like this is Hawkwind and the 80s coming to some kind of truce after a decade of some incompatibility, I would say. You know, we had Levitation, which was really nicely done. They had some of that more recording technology, but it was still feeling like it had some of that 70s psych still remaining, and a little bit more jazzy and trippy because of the drums and all that kind of stuff. But they still had some of this guitar, which feels much more intrinsically 80s to me. And then I felt like the 80s were starting to take bites out of Hawkwind with every album. But this time I really feel like they've clawed it back and made it their own in that way, which I was hoping that they would. So to end the decade on this album is quite a victory, I would say. This feels like a real album in the way that I experience it. You know, there's no little blips or tracks anymore. Anything that feels like it could have been a blip in a previous album is actually allowed to breathe and develop. In fact, this is the only Hawkwind album in the 80s that does not have a track under 2 minutes in length, which means that everything has got a little bit of time. Even if it's only 2 minutes, that's way better than, you know, the 36 second little blare that they sometimes throw in. So I do feel like this feels like an album. Given the fact they only had 3 weeks to do it, I'm surprised there aren't more little blips. You know, I'd expect this to be more like Church maybe, but actually I think it's one of the most complete feeling of the whole 80s for me. This album definitely proves that Hawkwind can still really put a song together. I've got to stop thinking as Hawkwind of these like plucky amateurs, you know, like we did at the very beginning. You know, they really can do this now, and I should stop being surprised when they do. But, you know, even with some of the experimental parts to it, I feel like those experiments land more reliably than maybe albums like 25 Years and Quark did even. I feel like a lot of these are much more secure and much more musical, so I enjoy them more in their experiments. You know, they're not so rough around the edges, they're a bit more smooth. They don't feel out of place in the whole album, which is nice. I think just from a production point of view, it's very on point. They've taken some of that speed from Chronicles and the live shows, I guess. But for me, they've tampered it again and made it feel like it's a listenable experience. It doesn't feel rushed. I think there's probably some drum machines in there, but I feel like the blend between live and synthetic drums is a lot nicer in this one. I'm personally a real fan of synthetic hi-hats. I just find them very compelling. I think that's just growing up on a diet of dance music. You know, like 909 drum machines is just like my happy place. So the fact that there's quite a lot of what I believe synthetic hats in here, I feel like my very specific drum tastes are very well catered for. And I think the album actually really rewarded repeated listening. You know, even today when I was just going through it again just to really refresh my brain, I was hearing new things and I was making new notes literally up until the time when we started calling each other, because I was like, oh, that was a little thing I didn't think about, or oh, that has a little reverse effect in it, or that has this extra little thing I wasn't really paying attention to. So this has been a really enjoyable experience, probably one of my favorite Hawkwind albums from the entire decade.
Well, that's outstanding. It's fascinating for me to hear, because this was the first Hawkwind album that I bought new on the day of release. Black Sword was the first current album I bought. But as I said before, I bought that a good number of months after it came out. I wasn't aware, you know, of the dropping of albums. I didn't know dates, but I was into Hawkwind enough and understood them as a current concern rather than just as a library of music to keep delving into, to look out for the release date and to go down to a record shop in Shoreham-by-Sea, which isn't there anymore, called A&M Records, and go up to the counter and go, have you got the new Hawkwind album? And then go home with it, put it on. The interesting thing was, it was really was in the shadow of Black Sword. I would have played it quite a lot because it was the new one and because I was going to go and see them live, etc. But I'd seen them do Black Sword in Brighton. I'd seen them at Acid Days that we talked about with Ian. And I don't think it really caught my imagination a huge amount back when I heard it then. And it's not an album in the subsequent decades that I've dug out and gone back to. But this is one of those albums, and there have been one or two of them, where I'm much more engaged with it now than I did then. Going back to it, I hear so much more in it now than I did then. And I think that's probably because my own listening has expanded so much in that time. Whereas, you know, reading out the albums from 1988 and recognizing the ones I had or the bands I saw, this doesn't fit into those genres. It's a little bit more exploratory, which I wasn't really doing much in 1988. So yeah, coming back to it has been a really interesting experience, and I found it very, very easy to listen to, which is something I think we'll get into a little bit more when we sum up at the end of the podcast. So let's dive in track for track. And we open with The War I Survived. This is one of the ones with lyrics by Roger Neville Neal. And in Ian Abraham's acclaimed book, Sonic Assassins, by the way, Ian suggested that he had a little uplift in sales following our podcast. So it's nice to know, although we are definitely a financially losing organization, we can make a few bob for someone. In that book, which you should all rush out and buy, Ian writes this. For the album opener, Dave Brock selected The War I Survived, a lyric that Roger had based on Kurt Vonnegut's novel Slaughterhouse-Five. Roger says, I was thinking back to the days when Calvert would select a book for inspiration. I listened to his music a lot, getting into his words and wit. So, although we know that a few months later we lost Robert Calvert, it's actually nice to know that there's a bit of Robert Calvert inspiration going on here, just even in the selection of the Kurt Vonnegut book as the inspiration for these lyrics.
Yeah, for sure. It's great to know that his legacy and techniques live on. The fact he inspired other artists and creators, which, you know, if you are an artist and creator, that is one of the highest honors, isn't it? When someone ever quotes you as an inspiration, that's always amazing. I think because I'd listened to Chronicles so much, I actually didn't get it and I was a bit nonplussed with it. Actually, I listened to this track and then I didn't listen to the rest of the album because I knew I wasn't ready. So I actually took a couple of days, listened to other stuff to try to cleanse my brain of everything that we had talked about before. I guess probably having the live album and the studio album back to back was so thick, I needed to really like clear that mental air. But when I listened to it again, as fresh as I could, I felt like this was Hawkwind in a way reintroducing the things that I like about them. You know, we have this frantic 5 minutes where we kind of learn again what Hawkwind's about. You know, we have sci-fi references with the Slaughterhouse-Five reference. We have war references with the whole War I Survived thing. We have existential human crisis references with the wanting to return to a never-ending war. We have cool bits of the 80s reference with big guitar solos. We have synthy references with cool atmospherics in the bass line. And we have Hawkwind annoying me references with the fade out just as soon as the song sounds like it's going to go into a cool B section. But all of this for me is like, cool, this is everything we put on the shelf as we worked with this other concept that we were playing with. Now we've taken this off, dusted it off, added some of this hard rock energy that we've still got in our veins, and now we're going to see what our other stuff feels like through this filter. So this to me is a really interesting track, actually, with a lot to unpack at quite a breakneck speed. But I think they do it probably in the right amount of intensity that I can still get it. And if you're going to talk about something like Slaughterhouse-Five, which I haven't read in a few years, but I always remember it being a pretty crazy story. So, you know, to decide that you're going to take that on is ambitious, but it's the kind of thing that I can see Hawkwind doing, and they did, so that's great. I like the fact that they open with this ominous clock ticking in this cool stereo effect. It's a great way of coming in cold with an interesting thing to, you know, wake your ears up. I wondered if that was some kind of sonic tag for the idea of time travel, considering they're going back to the war they survived, and I was trying to figure out which war they might be referencing, if they're referencing a real war or whether or not, you know, it's just the concept of a war. But Slaughterhouse-Five is about kind of World War II. And I thought actually when I was listening to this before I read the lyrics, they say the generals cry more, but I thought they said the Germans cry more. The lyrics on the internet says it's generals, but also 10% of the lyrics are written as unknown or indecipherable on the internet for this track. So I don't know whether or not I trust the internet this time. But, you know, given there wasn't a major conflict really going on in the late 80s, I assume they're talking about World War II. I feel like that's Hawkwind's war that they talk about. So for me personally, I'm assuming it's that. But anyway, it's a very difficult song to unpack lyrically, I think. You know, we could probably spend the whole podcast unpacking the line, I can't live no more, this is Slaughterhouse-Five, you know, given how complex that story is. And again, I haven't read it recently, but I've read it several times. It's an amazing piece of writing. My guess would be that seeing as the main theme of that book is largely about the inevitability of death and the differences between the concept of war on a large scale on your brain versus the much less justifiable inflicting of pain and suffering on a personal one-to-one level, that the song is kind of unpacking the dissonance of being the survivor in an environment designed to kill you, and maybe like the guilt and turmoil that can kind of cause you to go to the point where you feel like by surviving, you're somehow doing something wrong. You get that kind of survivor's guilt, that idea about returning to a war you survived in a way that's like a heroic thing, but also if everyone else is dying, then it's a strange feeling, you know. So I feel like there's something very huge and crazy in that, and the idea to want to go back to it makes you kind of wonder like where you are in order for that to be the place that you want to go to. So for me, it's a real Hawkwind brain melter that manages to blend upbeat musicality with deeply disturbing themes of an existential crises in a way that I feel like really only they do. I don't really see other people even trying to, but they, you know, they'll always take a swing at it, sometimes for better or worse, but I think this time for the better. I've definitely said in previous podcasts that I've heard a track that's made me think Hawkwind are back. And after the last few albums, which I've enjoyed parts of, but felt like some pieces have been missing, this opener, I feel like a man who was lost in a desert that's just had his first mouthful of lush oasis water or something. You know, I really do enjoy all the elements of this coming together. Musically, I think the track starts off with that cool intro with the clocks and this kind of like TIE fighter screaming sound effect. And then this extended drum fill, which just makes us feel like, okay, we're still keeping that high energy. And then this lyrical barrage is like thick and fast and does a good job of really carrying the track, because, you know, the guitar's doing these more longer extended chords that provide more of a backing, you know, before they come in to take care of the post-chorus section. So there's a nice call and response between the vocals having a go and then the guitars going my go and then back and forth, which I think is really nice. Goes back to that thing I was saying where like Hawkwind can arrange now in a way which I shouldn't be surprised with, but sometimes still when I listen to it, I'm like, oh, that's nicely done, guys, good job. And the lyrics come thick and fast, a bit like in Live's Chronicles. The speed at which they're delivered though means that their profundity is lessened a little bit when you're actually experiencing them. Like I had to read the lyrics to make sure I was getting it all. The fact that at least 10% of this whole lyric sheet is quote unquote unfound or unknown, which means that probably the delivery is not quite as strong as it could be. But the repeat listening makes you feel like you get into that. I don't think that's necessarily a criticism, because I'm not against, you know, doing some of the work myself and trying to figure out what they mean. But also at the same time, you have something like High Rise, which is able to do all the heavy lifting itself and allow you to just witness it. It's a creative choice, which I found a little surprising, maybe. But I think it works fine. I was just a little surprised given the chewiness of the whole subject matter. It's quite relentless in what it does. And I like the fact it keeps you guessing. It's got all these lyrics which are taking you on this very strange journey. It's always coming back to this theme of the crisis, but also musically, we occasionally like drop into halftime towards the middle of the track, which gives us this moment to like pause and bathe in some of these cool sound effects noises, which again feel very Hawkwind before we're brought back up to speed again. So they're always keeping you guessing, always keeping you on your toes. The two big drum fills in the track also make it feel like Hawkwind are making it clear that they're doubling down on some live drumming over drum machines, which is a move that I applaud for them. I just think it sounds better when they have that. The second big fill they do with the bass hitting this kind of like 1-2-1-2 note thing, almost this kind of marching feel, is also very satisfying. So this is them being able to blend a complex idea with a track which can also throw you around a dance floor. Which brings me to how saddening it is that the track doesn't end, but fades in that way that I always find unsatisfying, especially when we've just had this big fill, which builds to a bit of a lame payoff, which is a shame because it does sound like it's going to go into this new section. But to quote the great Slaughterhouse 5 book, so it goes.
So it goes. That's well said. And yeah, I must admit, coming to this, I really enjoyed The War I Survived. Again, as I say, much more so than I did when I first heard it back in the day. I like the fact that it's musically quite simple. Most of The War I Survived happens on a single note. The lyric is just all pounding away, but without changing note. For me, it's a little bit like rap to a certain degree, where for a long time, I didn't really care what the words were, because the sound of the syllables and the consonants hitting the meter just sounds kind of joyful in your head. There isn't a lyric sheet with the album itself on the vinyl. When I did look it up and I came across the big five question marks in the middle of a line, I thought how you'd be, if you did this as karaoke, you'd be completely sold down the river, wouldn't you? Be on stage. And you'd be, before you continue. Mm. But there are some wonderful lines in there. You know, the line, a bulletproof Bible can protect your heart. It'll cover your eyes when you're falling apart. You just grin when this comes up. And given how heavy the subject matter of the book is, the song is actually really quite a joyful experience, if you know what I mean, from that point of view. So, yeah, so I really like this. It feels like a real statement of intent. You know, that riff sounds like Hawkwind, basically, in a way that only Hawkwind can. So it was only fairly recently that I really looked into the lyrics. I knew that it was Slaughterhouse 5. That bit you can really take from the lyrics. But it wasn't a book I'm anywhere near as familiar with as you are, although I know a fair bit about it. It's not one that I've read in a very, very long time. But yeah, a really excellent start to the album. And good job, Roger, picking that as the subject matter for the track. It takes us into quite the mood shift with Wastelands of Sleep. And it's worth pointing out here that another album I bought at the time was the Dave Brock solo album, or at least I think it's solo album. It might be a few guests on it, but Dave Brock and the Agents of Chaos, which I really like. When we get to the end of the studio album run somewhere in the 2050s and we look at a few solo albums, it's probably the first one that I'll throw at Matt's listen to, because several of these songs are on that album, which means that there will come a time when you are listening to some of these Xenon Codex tracks again. And this is one of them. And despite what Alan said about Guy Bidmead not doing an awful lot, I quite like the production on this one, Matt.
I agree. I think it's nice. The one thing that annoys me about it, which again, it's not its fault as such, and probably more just the mastering or again, the arrangement overall, is the fact that I'd hope that after Choose Your Masks, Hawkwind would have fixed that flow breaking pause between tracks, but there's a full 9 seconds between The War I Survived having completely faded out and The Wastelands of Sleep starting up. And I know that I'm from an always on energy drink guzzling social media addicted attention deficit generation, but even so, that's an eternity after all the adrenaline the first track has pumped into you. So I always find this track is slightly coming in a kind of a tense way, because you're waiting for something to happen and then it sloshes in this smooth way, which after you've just had that previous track and then a gap, you're not ready for. So it always feels like a bit of a bump. But at the same time, when you're just listening to it with a forgiving spirit, it feels for me like I'm sinking into a nice bath of Hawkwind familiarity. A little bit like the first track was like, this is us with our sci-fi and our war and our craziness and bombast and Hawkwindness. This is the other version that Hawkwind are really good at. Sonically, it's highly reminiscent of Lord of Light again, but kind of the ambient version. I think, again, that might just be the way that the lyrics are delivered. We know that they've revisited Lord of Light before, but there's something in this to me which just, it always just comes to my head. So I have that somehow in it. But it also has recordings of birds in it, which we know is a Hawkwind staple now for atmospherics, which is always fun, and I like to hear those again. It's got those long wailing guitar tones, which I think, I think a correspondent a while ago mentioned that was done with an ebow, like they did on Levitation, so that's cool that that's come back again. I feel like the vocals have an almost Zarazenya delivery somehow to them, so I think it's Brock being wistful and waily again, but actually, you know, very tunefully, which is nice, because back in the 70s sometimes he could be a little bit wayward with his vocals, but this I feel like is really nicely delivered. And what adds to all these elements is both a really nice story and some really nice percussive choices. There's these very compelling kind of woodblock style clicks and taps, which sound like they're pitched to work within the key of the track. So there's something very nice, like this like gentle drum beat, but at the same time, it's very sonorous and it works really nicely to add little tuneful details. The whole thing sounds a bit Goa trance to me, which I know is 30, 35 years ahead of where this track is in the time. I like the name of the track. I think it's a cool concept. Conjures up for me these ideas of a vast area you drift through, but it's also kind of bereft maybe of the fantasy and dreams that you think also come with sleep. You know, it's more like a bleak unconsciousness maybe rather than a dreamful sleep. When you think of sleep as a wasteland, it feels like it's somehow unsatisfying. It's more just like being off compared to that idea of drifting off and going into internal fantasy land. So maybe all the fantastical elements of dreams have been plundered. So maybe the scene is now a wasteland. In this story, dreams are a finite resource, and this has been completely mined flat, so there's nothing left. Also, that kind of happens with trauma. You know, like people say that they don't have dreams or they find it hard to dream if they have something that happens to them in real life. So it's almost like this idea of this person's having some kind of crises in the waking world, which is causing them to then have these troubles in the subliminal world. I like the line, but you can always return tomorrow, because, you know, it's true. Sleep is this inescapable eventuality that we almost go to. But I think most people look forward to it. But if you know you're going back to a recurring wasteland, something which is normally seen as a nice thing is suddenly flipped on its head to be something that you're dreading. They suggest that sleep is a way to escape from sorrow. But at the same time, if it's a wasteland, are you escaping in a nice way, or is it more like it's just another place you go? So I like this idea that sadness from the waking life is somehow subconsciously tarnishing this landscape of this character's sleep world. And it has this kind of terrible duality to it, rather than like a positive loop. It's actually this negative spiral that ends only in sadness. And I feel like the tone of the track gives you that impression as well, whilst also being quite dreamy and compelling and also kind of soothing. So there's this dissonance in the same way that we had on the first track, where we're talking about wars and survival and craziness and generals and you know, ceaseless violence done to the kind of track that you could throw chairs around to. This track is much more wistful and that more kind of competitive style of Hawkwind track, but the vocals are actually saying, I'm having a really bad time. So these are both weird takes on what you would normally expect Hawkwind to do. So I like that they're still playing with their staples in fun ways. And as a listener who is more comfortable with this kind of stuff, I like that it still feels different, you know, that they're still exploring it in weird ways. But these back-to-back tracks are interesting in both their familiarity, but also their dissonance.
We're very much on the same page, I think. I really like the mood change here, and it reminds me of 1-2 punches on previous Hawkwind albums. We may have talked about that with Quark Strangers and Charm. Now, those tracks, I think, were actually thematically very linked. But again, you can take Wastelands of Sleep as a coda, if you like. I don't think they're written or intended to be that way, but they feel like these two tracks go really, really well together, basically, because of the contrast. And I like that journey that you go on out of, as you say, the madness of the war I survived. When I'm listening to this and I'm walking around, I find that it goes by very quickly because I'm in my own little world and then suddenly it's gone. So yeah, really nice piece. I do like this sound, the Hawkwind musical universe that they get into when they start doing these kinds of tracks. We mentioned the use of the word neon in song titles, and we get to Neon Skyline, which actually kind of contains in the Neon Skyline sandwich Lost Chronicles, which is the instrumental. But we'll just deal with the first bit of Neon Skyline.
Yeah, this is a difficult one, isn't it? Because after two perfectly fine tracks, we then get caught up in Hawkwind's weird way of arranging things, which is odd and has struck again. It's weird because it's the shortest track on the album, and yet one which I've developed one of the strangest relationships with, because it's in equal parts totally brainless and oddly compelling. I can't think of the last time Hawkwind did such a really basic four chord song. I'm thinking possibly it goes back to Assault and Battery, even. In fact, I played Assault and Battery after listening to this, and if it's not the same four chords, it's really similar. It's the most classic, almost Pachelbel's canon of da, 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 da. And cool, but every band has done something like that, and normally it doesn't make the album because it's so predictable. When I first heard this, I was really surprised. Because you said they had 3 weeks to do it, maybe they were like, oh God, let's just break out the four chord song because we need one. But this is short, and the next track is so complex and well done that I don't think that's the case. So I don't quite know what they're trying to do here. This trips me up as well, because the slight pitch bend at the start of this track, there's a kind of whoop, which sounds like, you know, when you put your pin on the record and then you press play rather than put your pin on a record which is already going. There's this little pitch bend which makes it sound like it's starting up in a kind of vinyl-y way, which for me always signals to me that this is the start of the album. It feels like the kind of thing that you do at the beginning. So I feel like we've had two tracks, then there's a break, then the album starts again, which doesn't help my brain anyway. And I found it very difficult to get over that for some reason. That may well just be my problem. it goes into then more of an atmospheric thing in the same way that the first track does. So again, it feels like you're building to something in a first track kind of way with these little pitchy atmospherics, which give me this feeling that we're in the engine room of an alien ship or something. I think they're quite nice. And then the drums assert themselves and like, okay, cool, this is going to be a song. And then we just ball our way into the full song really quickly. And then you just hit these four chords and you're like, oh, okay, well, that's a little bit pedestrian for Hawkwind, especially considering that they've just done two tracks which feel very them. And just as you're getting lulled to sleep by this predictable chord structure, I guess the chorus slams in, drums blazing. You know, you've got these huge kick snare fills. You've got this flattened vocals all shouting together. So there's this kind of unison feeling to it. You've got this slowly spiraling synthy shimmer, which adds to the intensity. And then it's all over and slides back into the four chord structure. And I'm left thinking, what the hell was that? Can I have a bit more of that? That sounded fun. You know, like it's a bit like what they did in the first track where they suddenly go into halftime, but this time they go into mega intense time. So I always feel like I'm kind of back-footed by this whole thing. And then you don't even have much time to think about it before it happens again. You know, it's almost like it's okay, chords, chords, chords. I wonder what that was. Oh no, here we go. Bang, bang, bang. We're going again. It's crazy. This song is like, have you ever been like in the sea and you get hit by a big wave you didn't see coming? You get knocked over, it leaves you blind and gasping, and you know there's another wave coming and you're not going to be able to get ready enough to not get hit by it. So you just kind of curl up and brace for it so you can try and pull yourself together. It feels like that. It feels like I get hit by a chorus. You know, while I'm trying to reel from it, the chorus just hits me again. It's very weird. And for all its basicness, it is the one that I've got to say to my shame gets stuck in my head almost more than anything else in this album. And I find myself walking the dogs or out shopping and singing the I changed my course, I had no choice, I always listen to my inner voice. I love that I always listen to my inner voice line for some reason. It just comes out of nowhere where I'm not even listening to music. I just get that lyric in my head for some reason. I find it really compelling. So it's really been my earworm for the whole time I've been listening, which is odd. The whole track is very confusing and you know, it's lively and exuberant. I just find its exuberance mixed with its basicness very hard to pass. It's still a confusing track to me. I think that's probably all I can say before we talk about it blending into the next track. So I'm going to stop there.
Exuberance mixed with basicness sounds like Space Ritual era Hawkwind recipe. That sounds demeaning. It's not meant to be. That's actually meant to be utterly brilliant. Had I had to come up with what would the Matt Earworm be, it would not have been this. I was a little bit meh on this, I guess, first time round, as I hadn't really connected with the album. This time round, energy-wise, it's like going back to The War I Survived, but without being as good as The War I Survived, is kind of how it sticks with me. But the chaotic part of it is really interesting, as you say. This is one of two Alan Davey tracks on the album. They tend to be quite energetic ones at that. But that chaotic nature of it does mean that it's really interesting, the fact that it then blends into the least chaotic track on the album, which is Lost Chronicles, which I have to admit, I'd utterly forgotten existed, Lost Chronicles. When I saw it in the track listing, when I got the vinyl, I was like, what is this? Then as soon as the piano chords hit, I thought, I know this. And it's interesting that it's a Harvey Bainbridge track, because given the big guitar solo that's in it, I would have put it down as a co-write with the guitar player. But I guess that's not how things work. But yeah, it's interesting that they decided that the place where this should live is in the middle of the chaos.
Yeah. To use my previous weird metaphor, this track comes in like the lifeguard to save you from the waves and drag you back to the sands. This track for me is quite wonderful. It's rich. It's layered. For the first time ever, I think the piano that they use feels played. And by that, I mean, there's a gesturality to it where you can feel fingers on keys and you feel like there's difference in the playing. It doesn't feel sequenced. I feel like someone hammered this out. There's a humanity to it. And I think that's the thing which compels me from the very beginning, where you feel like there's this humanity to it. It feels performed. It's also kind of campy somehow in the way it's done. I think, again, that's sort of the 80s-ness. But for me, it kind of adds to it. And that's the foundation for this to come in. You know, it's like, I'm a cool piano, which is going to come in not only with big chords, but also wandering around all of the keys to tell this little story. And then it just comes in confidently. It brings all these atmospherics in for texture. You know, there's this squiggly synth and loop synth and high synth, which do this good job of making space between the previous track and what we're about to hear, which is nice. While there is a transition, it does feel like, all right, everyone calm down for a second. I'm going to do this other thing now. So it doesn't come in out of nowhere. It is made space for, which is nice. It's probably one of the nicest bits of piano that Hawkwind have committed to tape so far, in my opinion. And I also like the fact that its confidence drags you along with it, a little bit like Golden Void, when that comes in, you know, hits that really shrieking note and comes all the way down and then brings you into that track. I feel like this has a similar kind of thing where it just comes in really confidently and you just feel like, oh, cool, I wonder what this is going to do. And it just does this amazing kind of circuit. And every time it finishes its loop, it just picks up another thing for the ride. You know, like on the first go round, there's some nice little cymbal washes and swooshing to add to this atmospherics. On the second go round, it adds this string-like synth to add this chorus effect. And then on the third go round, it drops this really simple beat, but it just works fantastically. And again, maybe it's my dance music sensibilities, but it feels like a big dance music breakdown. So when that beat drops in, I was so satisfied because I was just waiting for it. And when it did, it felt great. And then there's one more go round when it brings in these little hats and they just tick, tick, tick their way through it. And I was just in absolute heaven. I thought that was so beautiful. I love these little hats ticking through. I love this performance. I love the fact that we're layering and layering, and then everything we've been listening to suddenly takes a slight step back and allows this guitar to come in, which is just dripping with attitude. It's not doing too much, but it's adding again this interplay between what we've been hearing and enjoying and it being able to come back and form more of a bed for the guitar to come in. I never thought I'd enjoy myself with something which still sounds pretty 80s to me, so I thought that Hawkwind had achieved the impossible. And then it all goes weird. Not for the first time have Hawkwind achieved an instrumental which I really like, which they then managed to spoil at the end. But this time they do it in a very different way, not by just putting in a random horrible chord and slam at the end, but they decide to tune back into the previous track. The guitar solo comes to this very satisfying end. The synthy piano comes back to finish off its sequence. It hangs on this note. And I was thinking, oh, what a brilliant way of finishing. Just like, leave us wanting more. And then they're like, nope, we're going to have this weird sound like someone cocking a shotgun. And the previous track is going to barrel back in out of nowhere. And Hawkwind have made another decision which completely bewilders me. I just don't see the need to return to the previous track because it means that I can't enjoy the bit I like without dragging around this annoying, banal conjoined twin that has got attached to it. To use another really random analogy, I feel like there's this really tasty, juicy hamburger patty that for some reason has been served between two slices of stale bread, and I have to decide whether or not I'm going to eat it or if I'm just going to let it go. But either way is unsatisfying, you know? So I'll chalk this up to another Hawkwind experience that I can't fully enjoy. After the Shea Gate debacle, which I have not forgotten about, this feels like a habit that I'm really hoping Hawkwind will break soon, or them and I are going to have a falling out, because I don't like the fact that they pull me in with such good music and then find a way to resolve it in a way which I find really unsatisfying. It's a puzzle. Like, first time I listened to this album, I don't think I was looking at the track listings, so I thought this was just one long track, and I thought, okay, that's what they've done. There's an ABA section for some reason. But the fact it's over two tracks is somehow more annoying because it means that they've done it on purpose. And then it also fades out, just like all the other tracks have been fading out. So you just feel like it came in, it faded out. It did nothing apart from mean I can't put it satisfactorily into any of my playlists, and then it's gone.
It's weird, isn't it? I kind of think if you want to do the reprise of the previous track, there is an absence of these little 30-second tracks on this album. If you were going to have one, do that with it so that Lost Chronicles can live on its own as its own distinct piece, which it should, because if you do want to listen to this, you've got to accept the fact that it then runs back into Neon Skyline at the end, which I also tend to think that's not necessary. I'm quite happy that Neon Skyline has done its thing by the time that Lost Chronicles starts. If there was like a minute of Neon Skyline and then Lost Chronicles, I'd be thinking, well, Neon Skyline should have been longer, and then it would come in the end and I would go, okay, you split it in half. But actually, I've had my Neon Skyline fill when Neon Skyline finishes. So I would prefer it didn't come back in. I think in the context of the running order where we go next, it kind of needs to, because I don't think Lost Chronicles should go straight into Tides. One wonders whether they did it for that reason. Otherwise, I think you'd be looking to reorder this album quite significantly.
How were people consuming music? Was it still vinyl and tape? Were there CDs in 88?
It was vinyl and tape, I think. I think CDs were kind of 90s.
Yeah. If you have to listen to it pretty much in its entirety anyway, and you can't skip between tracks, then...
Doesn't really matter.
No, exactly. You might as well consider it being one track. It's just odd that it is actually technically two tracks, and one of the tracks just has the other track bolted onto it. Why they couldn't have just clipped it and made it three tracks?
Yes, exactly.
I guess they didn't have the foresight that we'd be able to pick tracks out specifically and build playlists and do all these other things. But even so, it's an odd decision.
And it means that by the time you get to CD and streaming, the people who are formatting it for that probably don't have the context of when it was put together to think those things. Yeah, it's very true, because on the vinyl, you really don't notice at all. And vinyl is the main way that I would come to this until for this purpose. I'd never streamed this album before until we were preparing for this podcast. I do love Lust Chronicles, though. As you say, layered stuff I really like anyway. And this, to me, this is Hugh Lloyd Langton's Dave Gilmour moment. Because you think of Comfortably Numb for David Gilmour, or you might think Firth of Fifth for Steve Hackett, where you have this signature point where the music only exists to be the background for the guitarist to go in and do his thing. There's nothing else. It's just, okay, I've set this up, knock that into the back of the net. And it's beautifully done, because again, as with all of my favorite guitar solos, in fact, probably with all guitar solos that I like, it's not a million miles an hour showing how fast you are on the fretboard and tapping and dive bombs and everything else, which I find criminally boring. It's like the Guitar Olympics, as I prefer guitar as an art form rather than as a sport. And Hugh plays it as an art form. And this is Hugh's last Hawkwind album. And I think it's a great testament to him for that reason.
Completely agree. I think in a way, while I'll be sad to hear him go, I would be interested to see what they would do next, just because he is all over this album.
Yeah.
And there isn't really a track which doesn't have that guitar in it. And while I like it, if there was another album straight after which was like that again, I wonder if it would start to get a little bit predictable. So while I love this, I'm not too sad that he goes and does something else.
He defines the 1980s Hawkwind for me, which is something we will get into in our 1980s wrap-up podcast when we get that far. We do have the singular Hugh Lloyd Langton penned track on the album, which is the instrumental Tides for side one.
Which is another return to Hawkwind familiarity for me, but this time it's the cool guitar that I thought we'd kind of lost to the 70s, but here it is in all its plucky goodness. I'm surprised it's not Dave playing it, because I feel like that was Dave's signature way of playing. But, you know, I think this is really nicely arranged. I think all the pieces layer on top of each other without getting in each other's way, which is quite hard to do. For me, it feels like, you know, those huge flocks of birds that all move like one giant mass. Mm-hmm. For me, it feels, listening to this, I almost see that in my head, you know, that it's moving around, but none of it's getting in each other's way, which is fantastic. We have these long bass notes which hold together the guitar as it kind of arpeggiates away with what I think is some kind of delay effect just to add some complexity to it. But I think that's really nicely done. Then the electric guitar is also, you know, like droning along with the bass to add some interest in that upper range, which is why I feel like, you know, we've got all the sonic basses covered, but they're not interfering, but they all sometimes hit the same note, which makes you feel like they're complete. And then they undulate in that kind of, I guess, tidal way. It's just a nice calming piece of Hawkwind atmosphere that's allowed time to breathe and develop in a way where in previous albums, maybe it wouldn't. Maybe this would have been a 1 minute thing rather than a much more satisfying 3 minute thing.
Yeah.
I do love the fact that this ends with this very sinister sounding chord just at the end. I actually like that. I think there's something really nice about it. Maybe there's a shark in the water after all or something. I don't know. But you know, there's just something in that fade out point. I was listening to this and I was really, really hoping that this track wouldn't be interrupted at the end by the sound of a cow being hit by a freight train or something stupid. So the fact it finishes on this little like minor sinister twang, I really like. So yeah, for me, it's a lovely little thing.
Yeah, agreed. Nice piece of atmosphere. I mean, I wonder whether with these things, whether the fact that they had 3 weeks means that something that would have been a minute and a half gets its, you know, we need a bit more. Can you do that for another minute and a half, please? But it actually kind of allows things to develop and go somewhere. And I do like this. And it closes side one quite nicely. Side one is such a contrast in chaos to calm, like a roller coaster ride between those things. And as the end of the vinyl for side one, it's always ended things out quite nicely for me, and is nice that it doesn't fade out, because funnily enough, if there's a track I thought they would fade out, it's that one. The fact that they don't is rather nice. I quite like that definitive end. So we turn the vinyl over and we are greeted with the track Heads, which is the second track on the album with lyrics written by Roger Neville Neal. It's also the second track on the album that also features on the Dave Brock and the Agents of Chaos album. Again, in Ian Abraham's book, Sonic Assassins, this is Neville Neal on the lyric for Heads. I had joined the Oxford University Speculative Fiction Group, which is where I first heard about Alcor Life Extensions Foundation, a cryogenic company in California where we can arrange to have yourself frozen for the future. Only one catch, you had to die first. It sounded like a good idea for a Hawkwind song. No argument there. What would it be like to be frozen alive? What would be your last thoughts as you drifted off into oblivion? Hawkwind introduced Heads into their set during 1987, the first time Roger heard the completed song. I purposely worked in the necromancy reference. Necromancy lives forever, preserved within a jar, as a joke to get the gossip types jumping to conclusions. It was great, Dave repeating that line, building it up. One of those conspiracy know-it-all types turned to me and proudly smiled. I knew he was into witchcraft. I cracked up laughing. Gossip types and conspiracy know-it-all types, whatever happened to them, Matt? So, Heads.
I feel like when you flip the record over, you flip reality with it. This side is much more experimental and a bit weird and colouring outside the lines. There's quite a lot to unpack here in the same way that there's quite a lot to unpack in War I Survived. And it's interesting that they both were then given to Hawkwind by this Neil chap. Does he ever do anything else, or is this like his one thing? Do you know?
I'm not sure. He's been around. And obviously the fact that he's still active now means that he kept going. Whether he did anything more for Hawkwind, I honestly cannot remember, but we will find out.
Okay. But it's interesting that he obviously was inspired by Calvert, which is cool. He's doing it in his own way, but it's nice to have a little Calvert-y presence within this. So, but it is very different. I still go hot and cold on this track a little bit. For me, it can be a mood thing. It's nice that we have some good old-fashioned Hawkwind experimentation. It is a surreal little story delivered in scary Brock voice, which is nice. Haven't heard that in a while. I would argue that it's not quite hitting the same level as Psy Power, but it's an interesting little idea that's delivered more like a song than a full story. So it's still nice to listen to. You know, it's not trying to be so much like a shut up and listen and there's some music. It is more in Psy Power where actually the music and the story are going together quite nicely. Sonically, for me, it's a real bass groover with this quite ubiquitous howling guitar over the top. So it does feel like it belongs on the album. And both of those things give a lots of room for Brock's vocals, which has that classic reverse effect, which again feels quite old school Hawkwind, so it's cool to hear that again. And there's this nice organy bed as well, which fills in when the guitar takes a break. So I feel like sonically it's all very together and arranged really nicely. I also quite like this big gated snare that keeps time throughout the track, this big kind of boosh as you get, which again feels very 80s, but I feel like it drives the pace along without overpowering it. So I think from a drum point of view, that was a good decision, considering that the music is a little sparse and a bit more atmospheric because of the vocals. And, you know, I think it's all solid. I think it's not super remarkable, but there's nothing wrong with it. And I think that's probably what it's supposed to be doing, because it means you can listen to the lyrics. And again, this isn't breakneck speed, so you are listening, which I think for me proves out my point that when you bring it down, you pay more attention. So the story then, given the fact the song is called Heads and we have this idea of necromancy being pickled and being preserved within a jar, it feels like we're dealing with that fairly classic idea of heads in jars that are still alive or unable to communicate somehow, even if they're in a state of being frozen. It's kind of
Futurama.
Exactly. I wrote that down. It's funny how a whole generation's go-to reference for this will be Futurama. And I was trying to figure out whether or not that's less sinister or more sinister than what Hawkwind are talking about. It's probably about the same. You know, overall, I think it's okay. There are a few really nice lines and a few lines that don't do much for me. So I'm going to call this a solid B- as Hawkwind stories go, and I will justify that. There are a few things that make this slightly hard for me to enjoy. One of them is the sudden blast of computer thinking sound that they throw in when Brock says science, which for me feels pretty dated by 1988, given the fact that the Macintosh 2 is out by this point. So, you know, we're not dealing with Buck Rogers anymore. You know, we're actually dealing with some fairly sophisticated home computering. So that is not needed. Also, that lyric, necromancy lives forever, preserved within a jar, kind of bugs me. Because to me, necromancy is the practice of communicating with or controlling the dead and is not the name of the thing which is dead. That's normally like a zombie or something. So saying necromancy lives forever for me is like saying painting lives forever or shouting lives forever. It's a practice or an action, and those things don't live for me. I probably wouldn't care so much, but the fact it's repeated over and over, I feel like this error is being rubbed in my face somewhat. It's like someone singing 2 + 2 = 5 over and over, to the point where I'm like, I would have let this go, but the fact you're still going on about it is really kind of annoying. Am I being petty? Maybe a little, but because of the mood that the end of Lost Chronicles puts me in, I feel a little less charitable towards it most of the time. So yeah, maybe I am being petty, and probably most people can get over. And, you know, I'm expecting emails, but I want to say it. The line is not quite as clever as it thinks it is. I don't hate it. I found it interesting enough to engage with it. I get that this is a necromantic power and it's applied to a head, meaning it lives forever and it's preserved within a jar due to science and has crossed a few ethics barriers, but I guess you can still call it science, you know. But it's not saying that, and I'm having to do that translation, which is why, even though I know what that line is doing, the fact it's not doing it and it's repeatedly not doing it, it kind of bugs me. But to be nice to the track, I think it is delivered well. I think Brock sings it nicely. I think the idea is interesting. There is something about the repetition in general that I enjoy. It's just annoying that that's the line that was repeated. Do you know what I mean?
No, totally. Lyrically, it is the kind of junior partner to The War I Survived, I think, as the album goes. It is a lovely concept. I love what the song is about. In terms of Roger going, this is what I'm going to write a song about, that is definitely someone finding very apt material for a Hawkwind track.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting also in that Calverty thing is that when we were listening to the Calvert era Hawkwind albums, the lyrics are not really written quite so much as song lyrics. So the music is just a bedding for the words to sit on top of, rather than thinking in terms of hooks and choruses and rhymes and things, if you see what I mean. And the same is true of the two tracks here, where Roger's written the lyrics and then music has been created to back the lyrics. But very effectively, that's not in any way intended to be a negative, just an observation. And I didn't think about that at all until we were preparing for this, because until that point, I hadn't looked into who wrote them, what they were about or anything like that. I came to this having not heard the album or looked into the album for a very long time. But it is interesting to look at it in those ways. But yeah, it's a nice intro to side two. It's probably not one for me that would stand out if I was doing the picks. I probably wouldn't pick Heads, but that's not because Heads is bad. It does a perfectly good job. And I actually don't think there is really a bad track on the Xenon Codex. But that takes us into the depths of side two, where we hit the mutation zone.
Yeah, which is a fun, janky, quirky little thing. The first time I heard it, I was unsure, but have actually come to quite enjoy its charms, actually. I think almost everything about this track is different and weird, so I'm into it. Given the fact that we haven't had one of these in a while, it's nice to see that Hawkwind is still playing with stuff. You know, I like the fact that in a way, everything in this is mutated in itself. You know, the drums sound like someone in large boots stomping on sheets of plywood instead of drums. The synth is all chopped up into tiny little like glitchy particles, which add this jittery energy to this otherwise quite like languid pace. So, you know, that's playing off each other interestingly. You know, the lyrics are delivered in a very filtered way. You know, it's all distorted treble. So it's almost being shouted through a bullhorn in another room, which you can't quite hear, which is interesting. It's also, I think, the first time that Hawkwind has sworn in a track. I don't know if that's true or not. I think they've cursed in a way. You know, there might have been like a damn or hell or something, but certainly that was surprising. So I feel like there's lots of things in here which knock you out of what you think Hawkwind can be capable of. But I kind of, you know, I don't mind that. I think it's them playing with their own expectations, which is cool. You know, so everything's mutating. There's a nice connection then between the story and the music altogether. I feel like there's a strange callback to tracks like Damnation Alley in the content of this. You know, we've got themes of nuclear destruction, survivors that don't sound like they'll be surviving for very long. general existential dread. It feels very classic again. So it seems like familiar. So it's quite welcome. I like the line, your body is not your own. It's got a nice reference to the idea that mutations can occur that we have to deal with, the idea that we are biological shells for our brains and sometimes things happen to us and it's beyond our control and we just have to learn to live with it. RoboCop came out in 1987. And for some reason, I get that feeling that everyone looks like that guy who falls into the toxic waste and then, you know, comes out all melted before he explodes when he gets hit by a car. I get that in my brain when I think about this track. But also the way the vocals are delivered makes it sound like it could be American, could be bombed out America. It could be a planet where this has happened. But, you know, it has that feeling that we're exploring again and being told a story of the people who are there where we've ended up. So overall, I think it's a fun bit of Hawkwind weirdness. And like the track before, it shows that Hawkwind can still have a twisted sense of humor when they feel like they want to. And I'm glad that that still persists because it hasn't been allowed to breathe for a while. So for Hawkwind to have permission to run around and be weird throughout pretty much the whole of side two, I think this is a fun little track and is welcome.
Absolutely. And I do like this. It reminds me of Sonic Attack, but the Sonic Attack from the Sonic Attack album. Partly that might be simply because it is Harvey Bainbridge's voice and the subject matter. It just reminded me of that kind of position of something which is very experimental, lots of electronics going on, blippy noises and things. And I really like that. So yeah, again, as a different tone for the album. Yeah, really nice. And one of the tracks that I did remember coming back to the album was that this was on there. Mainly that first line, Mutation Zone is my home, is one that would just run through my head because of the way that he sings it. I would just walk around with Mutation Zone is my home, just going round and round in my head because of the fun way that he sings it. And I think this was something that Harvey did a lot of, given that he moved from bass into the keyboards. Obviously, he was very passionate and interested in getting deeper and deeper into what those things could do, coming up with these kinds of tracks. And the next one is one of his as well. I don't know what EMC stands for. And when I looked at the track listing, I looked at EMC and thought, I have no idea what that is. But again, when it came up, I remembered the guitar riff. And apparently, this was Harvey trying to make a trance tune, which took me massively by surprise because it does not sound like a trance tune. And that may be Harvey having a bit of a beef with Guy Bidmead, the producer. But to be fair, if Guy has produced Whitesnake and Motorhead, and we've listened to Heads and Mutation Zone and now EMC, you can totally see why he probably sat in a chair and smoked his fags, because he's a little in the mutation zone of his own, isn't he, at this point? But EMC, Matt.
There's some places which call it EMC, like, you know, E.M.C. and some which just say EMC, like EMC. And I'm assuming it's EMC.
Yeah, I mean, there is always E equals MC squared, and you wonder whether that might have something to do with it, but I've not found anything that says it does.
There's a point where it says literally EMC, and I'm wondering if whether or not he just grabbed one of the little snippets of vocals that is in this and went, that'll do. Maybe it doesn't need to be called anything. It more just is. For me, it's another reintroduction of previous Hawkwind staples, which is messing around with samples. I think it's much more of a standard track, quote unquote, compared to the previous two. You know, this piece has a perfectly serviceable drum and guitar foundation. But for me, the points of interest are the samples and the treatments of the vocals. So we are getting a little bit zippy and techno and weird in some places. You know, we have these layers of Morse code bleeps, what sound like newscasters and broadcasters from space, maybe all merging together to form this audio collage of classic news media, like Some People Never Die, but far more abstract. So I feel like, again, there's a little bit of a return to an idea that they had, but maybe a little bit more standard compared to Some People Never Die, which was more of an art piece, I always thought. I also feel like the spoken dialogue has this very fast, zingy delay on it, which creates this springy, zippy, metallic tail to everything, which again adds to the surrealism. So even the stuff that they're making themselves and haven't found feel treated and weird. And there's this one recurring chopped up loop of speech, which has been like reversed and messed around with to create this funky audio bed that persists through the breakdown and the main part of the track. And that's the kind of thing that pulls you through the whole thing, I think. The guitars and the other synth stuff feels like it's faded in rather than played live and mixed together. So it does feel like it's a track which is more recorded and then represented rather than the other tracks, which feel like they could have all been played in studio and then taken care of on a mixing desk, but produced live. overall, there's some nice energy to it. I wouldn't call it trance, but certainly it's a bit more driving and dance focused than some of their other stuff. For me, trance is a lot more big synth arpeggios and stuff like that. But I guess maybe 1988 trance might be a little bit more like this. I don't know. My knowledge of trance is a bit more late 90s. So I'm not going to pretend to be an authority on 80s trance. I think the breakdown gets a little lost. I think that's probably a bit overlong. I feel like we lose some energy, but once you're back in the thick of it, you kind of forget about it. But I just feel like when I'm in the breakdown, I'm a bit like, this could be a little bit shorter and a bit snappier, but generally the track's a lot of fun. There's a lot of stereo processing on it, actually, which helps to create this really nice atmosphere. I finally got around to wiring up my big Sonos play bar the other day and played it through that. It really threw the track all over the place, which actually was really cool. So I enjoyed that. And I think there's something really nice about that. It just adds a lot of width and therefore an extra kind of complexity and takes all this choppiness and really plays with it in the stereo field, which is great. There's a couple of samples which I would say were misguided. I feel like halfway through they add in what sounds like that alert that big trucks do when they reverse. And the first time I was listening to this, I think I was out with the dogs and I paused the track to make sure I wasn't going to get flattened and then realized that it was the track. And I think it took quite a long time for me to realize that it was the track. And I haven't really still got that in my head. So I feel that can be kind of annoying. So I wish that that wasn't in it. But beyond that, it's a nice energetic piece. I think it's also arguably after Tides, the first track which doesn't fade. I think they really stick the landing by just going into that strange little cut up thing and then just stopping on the end of that choppy loop, because you're left with this kind of surge of energy that for me then massively benefits the next track. So yeah, this is fun. It's a different type of experimentation. It's not weird. It's just playing with some sonic stuff in a way which Hawkwind have been wont to do, but again, haven't done in a while. It's a solid thing, weird title notwithstanding.
Agreed on all counts. Again, a fun piece. It's one that takes me by surprise when it starts, but then I enjoy it while it's playing. And takes us into what I think for many would probably be the big track on this side of the album, Sword of the East, Alan Davies' second track.
I would agree with that. I would even go as far to say that for me, this is Hawkwind's new Silver Machine. I think they've been trying so long to try and make one, but then for me, out of nowhere, I found this track is pretty near perfect for a spiritual successor in a very different way. But for me, it's compositionally really intelligently made. I think it's really well produced. I think you could crush this down to a 3 minute 20 radio edit and have a real banger. I guess that didn't happen because I've never heard of it until I started listening to this album. But I was surprised. I think for me, this is probably one of Hawkwind's real hits that just feels different to everything else on the album. I think the opening is great because I feel like there's a lot of energy from the previous track that this track is able to grab and persist with. The opening's really catchy with this really nice little synth refrain. And it does this cool little trick, which sounds like it's being sequenced and played one way. And then when the beat drops, you realize it's working in a different way that you were thinking it was, which is always fun. And for me, that's actually a trance trick. You get this kind of arpeggiation in a breakdown. And then when the kick hits, it's like arpeggiating in a slightly different way because of where the kick is. You're like, oh, they got me. And for me, it does that, which is great. And it's not easy to do. So the fact that they pulled that off, I appreciate that as someone who grew up with club music in the 90s. And then, you know, the rest of the instrumentation drops in. We have this great wall of sound from the guitar, the bass, the drums, with that little synth just adding interest to the top. And I feel like it's at a satisfying speed. It blends a driving pace with enough room for the instrumentals to breathe nicely so you can take them all in. And then the vocals come in. And here is what makes this special, is that it's done in that unison style that Hawkwind have done to great effect before, but again, not for a while. And I'd say probably not really on this album. So it does feel bigger, livelier, more special here. And the fact it's going up and up and up in the way that it's delivered, it has that Silver Machine feeling that we're rising. And then for me, it becomes very energizing. It's one of those very few tracks that makes you want to sing along or put your hands up. It makes me want to run to a shop and buy a lighter so I can wave it around when I'm listening to it at home. It has this infectious quality that I really like. I think the lyrics themselves are fine, but they have a great rhythm to them, which means that you get something new on every line, but it leaves enough space for the music to also be a key part of the whole thing. So we have this push and pull, which I think is really nice. It means you start to hear the extra guitar come in for the chorus. You hear the bass doing a lot of work, really, to keep the intensity. I feel there's a lot of note fills in the bass. The bass is working really hard, and that's really nice to be able to hear that, because it's not something that you always get out of Hawkwind, or something that, again, with repeat listening, you realize, oh, that bassist is actually working a lot harder than you think maybe they are. So it's nice to be able to hear that. For me, it's kind of funny that after not really caring about Swords at all throughout the last two albums, I suddenly think that this Sword of the East is pretty cool. They finally got me with one last attempt at talking about swords.
The Chronicle of the Black Sword of the East.
Exactly. I just needed a geographic location. But but for me, this sword is more in the style of Hassan Sibar or something rather than a fantastical sword.
100%.
This has this very familiar Hawkwind theme of hopelessness in war, with the lines like, the children you bear are born into war, their eyes of despair your generals ignore. You know, there's almost a parity there between The War I Survived, with that idea of generals don't care, that it's going to send you off and everyone's going to die. So it's worn but comfortable territory for the band. I don't think that's a bad thing. I think, again, they're taking what they've learned and put it in this way, which sounds really, really nice. I feel like it should have ended stronger. We get this cool guitar solo at the end, and then we slowly fade out. And I feel like the track deserved to end on a little bit more ceremony than it does. But that seems to be the theme of this album, and my complaints are clearly falling on deaf ears here. So I'll just assume that that's what people were still doing with albums like this, or maybe they didn't have a clue how they were going to finish it. But overall, I think it's a really, really nice track. Every time I hear it, I just feel very energized. I feel like the whole album is very energizing, but this is a great way of being the penultimate bit of energy that we get. And if you think about this track being pretty much the last thing you hear from Hawkwind for the decade, it really feels like they've collected themselves, taken, you know, some of the best bits that they've learned throughout this 8 years of making music in the 80s, and have really served up something quite special. So I'm really glad that we have this on the album as a real high point.
And it totally is. It is the track that everybody talks about with this album. So this is one of those occasions where the big track that you've identified is the big track that everybody else tends to identify, and very much talked about as a kind of spiritual successor or sequel to Hassan Sibar. Probably mainly because of the lyrical content. And when you put the lyrical content together with the music, you can see how that pans out. And I think it's pretty obvious that Alan was a big fan of that tune. Great bass player for Hawkwind in that kind of driving way that he was. So yeah, it definitely stands out on the album, and probably given the sequencing of the album as it is, it kind of has to be in that prime position on side two to glue side two together. Because side two ends with a track that I think both I and all of Hawkbinge listenership have been looking forward to hearing your views upon, because, of course, the way that Hawkwind end tracks is such a theme that runs through a lot of the albums that we've covered. And I don't think there's a way of ending a Hawkwind album more elegantly than I think they do here. So good evening, Matt.
What a strange way to end the album. I have complained that Hawkwind have ended tracks weirdly, and this is taking that gripe to the extreme conclusion of ending the album on one big pile of weirdness.
They're just trolling you now, Matt.
Yeah, honestly, they knew we were going to do this somehow. I thought this might have been Hawkwind's attempt to get played on John Peel or something. You know, sometimes he liked things that were just so odd that it would end up on their Peel sessions or something. But I can't understand what their motivation for this was. I'm trying to figure out if this was their Punk's Not Dead track to try and end the 80s with, you know, as like a last hurrah for that for some reason, with the whole like get a job thing and shouting and everything feeling very like DIY and crazy. But it's just strange, after everything we've heard on this album and after the grace and intelligence of the previous track, that they ended it on this. And I don't mind this. I'm just surprised by it. I don't want anyone to think that I'm some kind of prude who doesn't enjoy exuberant weirdness, because I have plenty of records of stuff which is very odd. I've been to Cafe Otto in London and watched someone drag a slab over another slab for half an hour with an echo pedal. I've been to weird things. This is just slightly juvenile, the kind of thing that they want kids to play to their parents to make them feel like, I don't understand the youth of today, and then feel like all funny and anarchic or something. in a way, it predicted that early cut and paste music that the early internet picked up, and this huge mash of sounds over like rudimentary music loops and that kind of thing. And maybe this was weirder and more interesting when it came out in 88. I don't know. All I know is that someone who was raised on a diet of the internet, this is not something which I'm terribly impressed with. When I was a kid, I remember finding, I think it was Windows 95 or Windows 98, the media player allowed you to mess around rudimentarily with sounds and also stitch sounds together. And I remember recording the laugh at the end of Michael Jackson's Thriller, that kind of, ah, ha, 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 ha. I took that and found I could reverse it. And it turned into this big riser. It sort of went, shoo, shoo, ah, ah, ah. Back in the day, you had video game CDs and you could unpack them. And they would normally have all the soundtracks as WAV files. So I would take the funniest WAV file I could find and put it on the end of that sound. so it would just go, ah, ah, for example. I did that 100 times and I thought that was really, really funny when I was a kid with a computer. What I did not do was try to charge money for it and put it on an album. And that's the thing which annoys me about it. There's some exuberance in it for sure. There's even this weird bit where they kind of sing the main theme from If I Was a Rich Man, which just adds to the whole strangeness. And then ending it completely on, let's put as many quote unquote random sounds in there as possible, like random animal sounds and explosions and fart noises and all this kind of stuff. I don't know. I just feel like as a way to round out the whole decade, it's odd. You know, ending this album on the track before would have made much more sense. I feel, again, this is Hawkwind's slight thing where they can't let a good thing be and have to do something to it to ruin it at the end. And I have the luxury now of nixing this track off the album when I listen to it, so I can do my own edit and decide that they actually finished on Sword of the East and be very proud of them, rather than this little thing which they've kind of added on in that kind of, you know, I have old new metal records where there would be that thing where the last track would end and then there'd be like 2 minutes of silence and it'd have the Easter egg track, which was just complete nonsense for like 40 seconds because the band thought it would be funny.
There was quite a lot of that, wasn't there, back in the day?
Yeah, there was. I just feel a bit nonplussed by it, and I don't think it's smart enough for it to be ironic. I think it might be a bit punky and a bit weird, but, you know, I'm not trying to be prudish or too like highbrow about it. I just don't think it's done particularly well given the rest of the album, which is exasperating given how much I actually like this album and the fact they didn't ruin any tracks for me. Their attempt to ruin the whole album at the end is a new level of them being annoying.
So I have a couple of thoughts on this one. I wonder, given the fact that they had the 3 weeks and they were rushing it, I wonder if they were left in that scenario where they need another 3 minutes of music.
Mm.
In Sonic Assassins, they talk about going slightly mad in the studio. I think one of the readings mentioned it. I can imagine them having captured on tape them goofing around. And then basically they did really what you're talking about, stitched it together. Dave apparently did tack on that ending. So I can imagine them going, we need another 3 minutes of music, and then just basically doing what you're saying the internet does now, and in desperation gluing a whole bunch of random bits together to make that track and add that ending to it. We'll get to this in the artwork, but Dave refers to himself as Dr. Has-Been, and in some of the singing or shouting in this, there is the "just because we're has-beens" to the tune of If I Was a Rich Man, which makes me wonder if they'd been slated in the press and called has-beens, and this is them giving their response. I asked around and no one has any evidence of that, but it's interesting that they seem to have fixated on this term has-been on the cover and in these lyrics. I can't help, whenever I hear that, I think of not just If I Was a Rich Man, but I think of Topol, who obviously sang that on the TV version of Fiddler on the Roof that I grew up being shown on television. And then the fact that Topol then plays a character in For Your Eyes Only, the Bond film, which means there are several degrees of separation between Hawkwind and James Bond, which made me realize that Hawkwind really should do the theme tune for the next Bond film. Bond drops a ton of acid and travels the astral plane looking for Blofeld's cat or something like that. So, yeah, it is a very strange way to end, but it does feel to me that it was a patching of things together to fill out the vinyl.
It's interesting that I think the last time that we heard that story that Hawkwind were under time, they managed to produce Children of the Sun, which is, I know, a track that you really like and a track which I've actually grown fonder of.
Right.
And it's funny that 10 years later, they've gone from amazingly being able to create Children of the Sun and then creating this. It feels like a very different thing.
Exactly. One feels like, although they may have been under time, they seemed quite relaxed about it. One feels like there is major stress going on at the point that that's put together. So that rounds out the Xenon Codex, which is quite a fun time. It's also a fun time with the artwork for this one, Matt, because they've kind of gone back to being experimental with the artwork as they used to do. So it's interesting that Roger talked about his lyrics and being inspired by Calvert, because this artwork very much feels like it's inspired by Barney Bubbles, particularly when you go back to In Search of Space or Space Ritual, those big fold-out covers. And this is Bob Walker. I'm kind of fessing up now. I said Bob Walker did the artwork for Live Chronicles. And having said that and then put the podcast out, I then looked for the reference where I'd read that and couldn't find it. So he may not have done Live Chronicles, but not only does nobody correct me on that, I don't think anybody really knows. So let's just pretend that he did. But if he didn't, he did do the artwork for the Xenon Codex. And that is interesting because he did do that inside sleeve for Chronicle of the Black Sword that neither of us really like. But then he goes and does the Xenon Codex cover artwork, which is quite something.
It is, and it's very different. So the ability for some of the repeated Hawkwind artists to always change up styles is quite amazing. People are always doing new things and bringing new ideas. I wouldn't say that the artwork is particularly relevant to the content of the album, but it doesn't mean it's not cool, if you see what I mean. It's funny because on the Apple Music version, it's a blurry mess, and I had no idea what it was apart from this kind of diamond with some thing in the middle. And now I can't not see what it is. But when I was first looking at it, I'm like, this is just a blue and red mess. Oh, well. And then you sent me a high definition version of your album. And I was like, oh, no, that is great. It looks like something out of Judge Dredd.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
It's gone back to that kind of fascistic tone a little bit.
Which I think it's inspired by. Yeah, the Astounding Sounds, the back cover.
Yeah, it's interesting in the diamond, but also in your version, when you can pull it out of the diamond, it is a big square.
Yeah.
And it has this big authoritative gargoyle CCTV camera stone bird that looks like it's out of, one of the Darkest Timeline comic books. I think it's gorgeous. I love as well this crazy perspective that they've got where you're looking down into like a sheer drop. And then as it comes up, as the bird wings swoop towards you, you then come up to a skyline. So it looks very New York-y or Metropolis-y or something. I think actually the whole thing is flipped. So I think they've done it once and then just flipped it. The symmetry adds to that feeling of being in a city, I guess, but like a weird city where it's not complete chaos. There's a kind of order to it, but a city with too much order always feels wrong. You know, a city should feel more like someone dropped a whole sack of groceries and that's how the topography of the whole thing is.
Yeah.
When it's like this, it has that feeling of there's too much order.
And it adds to the vertigo too, doesn't it? Because it almost creates an arrow pointing straight down.
Exactly. And then the bird wings point down as well. So you feel like it's almost trying to tempt you to jump off that vantage point and just save it the trouble. But yeah, the big laser eyes, the Cyclops from X-Men kind of laser beams or searchlights or whatever it is that's going on. And the sharp relief of the red against the darkness of the city and all the lights being on. It's a very powerful image and just looks great. I'm sure it made a great t-shirt.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. It is a wicked album cover. And you kind of get more, as you do with these covers that are kind of multifaceted, you get more out of it, even just on the back cover, where the color scheme of the back cover, again, is reminiscent of that back of Astounding Sounds, Amazing Music. Which was all, I think, orange, black kind of colors. This time, obviously, more red, black thing going on with the city again represented. So even were it just the front and back cover, it's still a really striking cover.
There's a car in it which is flying, but also looks like a 1920s car. So there's a strange stylistic mix here where it's almost dark Metropolis.
Yeah, it's kind of Art Deco, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. And also there's the Drill Moth Woman, which I think when we first started doing Hawk Binge and I was doing some image research for what our logo was going to be, this is the recurring image and I was waiting for it to show up. And the fact it showed up here is interesting because, again, it's a very powerful thing. And as you open up the album itself into this T shape, there's this dual drill bit moth women in this geometric space chaosness, and they all look very sharp and pointy and dangerous in a very cool way. I think it's a great graphic. I don't know if they do anything more with it in future, but at least when I was doing research, it was coming up a lot on internet searches. So I guess it's something which is pretty emblematic of Hawkwind, at least in some point in time.
Absolutely. And funny enough, when I open it out like that and you get the black and white side, because Space Ritual had the color side and then the black and white side, with the black and white side here, this illustration reminds me so much of the John Coulthard work in that booklet that we had with Church of Hawkwind.
Yes.
I was slightly surprised that it wasn't John Coulthard, but I do love that image. And it's so reminiscent of that early 70s period, the big vortex that it goes into. And even then, the weirdness of the fact that in the circle is the chessboard with the pair of eyes looking out is the kind of really weird, arbitrary piece of artwork to put in that circle. It just takes your brain somewhere else.
No, 100%. I was saying to you when we were looking at this before we recorded that I thought that we'd seen a chessboard or some kind of game board floating in space before, but I went back over everything and I couldn't for the life of me find it. I don't know whether or not that triggers anyone else's brain, but it's the kind of strange image you'd expect to see from the logbook.
Exactly that.
Yeah, it's very graphic. It's kind of oddly profound in a strange way. You don't quite know what it's saying, but you feel like it's saying something. So it does speak to you in an interesting way. Is the board sentient? Is that a mask? There's lots of strange things it could be.
Exactly.
Those eyes are not happy with Pawn to King 2 at some point. It's going to get blinded.
No, exactly. And then you flip back to the color side and the bit where the band members are introduced. You have this strange, I'm going to say, a cult looking emblem going on in the middle with the word Mentet, which I couldn't find any meaning for anywhere. It just defaulted to Mentat and started talking about Dune, which is not what that says. And Xenon, 1988, but written in that particular way on top of what, you know, you think of as the chessboard with the calling all chrononauts, the phoenix has risen, which actually took my mind back to the Doctor has been just because we're has-beens. You thought we were all past it, but here we are, almost that kind of a feel to it. But again, it's a very striking image and a completely different kind of symbol to the rest of the album artwork entirely.
I find it slightly dissatisfying that the black rays are not coming out exactly from the black squares on the chessboard. I feel like it wouldn't have been too difficult to make that happen, but
yeah.
I guess it doesn't matter that much. It's funny that in the credits on the black and white side, Dave Brock calls himself Dr. Has-been and everyone else has names. And then in this version, he's the only one with his name and everyone else has strange names. So it's like a strange switch where he's actually Baron Brock and everyone else are called, like, you know, Alchemical and Rocky Paths and that kind of thing. So it's playful and weird. And I feel like these sketches feel a little bit more familiar with maybe the previous illustrations and less like big, bold and graphic. Looking at this as someone who has no idea what it is, it feels like it could have been part of an ad campaign or something to get people to look at it or something. I mean, I look at it and I'm like, cool. I prefer the black and white side, I guess, in terms of interesting things to look at. But, you know, as a thing to have made, it's perfectly fine. And to your point, it's nice that they are delivering an album which is more their remit of an audiovisual thing compared to the last album, which, even though it was a double album, was not even a gatefold or anything clever like this. It was essentially just like a single sheet in low contrast sepia. This feels like a return to form.
Absolutely. One of the strange things about it is the material, which is almost more like glossy paper. You can just pick it up and it just bends. So it's not the normal thick card that you have albums in. Now, I was back then unusually sensible, put all my albums into protective plastic sleeves. So mine is in absolutely mint condition. But if I hadn't done that, this material being a little bit on the thin side, I have a feeling it would be pretty worn at this point. So I'm very happy that I did that, particularly for an album cover, which is such an excellent piece of art as this one is. So far, we've got a really good album, which is packaged up rather beautifully, which is a really nice way to bring the 80s to a close. But we have something else, which is that I saw them at Hammersmith Odeon on this tour. The aforementioned Mad Professor's Laboratory Tour, which was quite something to behold. I couldn't find any images of it, by the way. So if anybody has any, then please do share them somewhere. But there were huge tubes full of glowing neon liquid and smoke and things. All of the band were wearing big white lab coats. So it was pretty nuts. Again, it was a stage concept. The whole thing tied together really nicely. And I still have the program from the 1988 show. So, as we are wont to do on Hawk Binge, whenever we have a program or a booklet or anything, then we have photographed and collated all that and uploaded it. And we will be sharing a link so that everybody can download and enjoy that one. It's a pretty interesting piece of work, isn't it, Matt? Particularly that big centerpiece.
Yeah, this kind of strange Hawkwind take on a board game with a whole bunch of anarchic board pieces, like a police confiscate your stash, go back three turns and these kind of things.
So, exactly.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Again, it's got that scrapbook style where some pages are just someone's handwriting and then some pages are really nicely designed full page illustrations. And I did see this one. There's a few pages which take care of some of the lyrics, not all of them, but some. But there is a page dedicated to heads where the band members have their heads in jars, which is kind of fun. And I do like the slide next to it, which is pictures of the bands when they were about eight or something and trying to figure out who they are and what delinquents they grew into, which is a lot of fun. But yeah, it's a great little thing. And yeah, that fold out is something else. We did a full scan of it and then we've taken the pictures of a few of the more interesting detailed shots as well, so you can see what it is. But yeah, we should give it a go sometime.
Absolutely. It definitely comes from that festival, Us Against the Man point of view. So it's a really nice one. So hopefully you will all enjoy downloading that when you get it. Matt actually found the tour poster that had all of the dates, which is how I realized that the album had come out on the 25th. So I saw them at Hammersmith Odeon and the album comes out just after the Hammersmith dates. So if you saw them in St. Albans or Hanley, Cardiff or Leicester, you will have had the ability to have listened to the songs before hearing them live. Otherwise, that was the first time that you would have heard them, and they played a number of them because they always do. It's quite a good poster though.
Yeah, I've just noticed as well that it says also available on cassette and compact disc. So I guess compact discs were around, but I'm wondering if maybe they were a form which not everyone would have had, because, you know, that's obviously an entirely new media player and that kind of thing as well.
The fact that it's listed after cassette and it's spelled out as compact disc rather than CD, it does feel like a novelty, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's yet to be the ubiquitous medium.
Exactly. So that's the thing that we'll put up in the socials with everything else. So Matt, that is the Xenon Codex. Before we start to look at where it ranks and take our selections for the playlists and all that kind of thing, any concluding thoughts on the album now that we've had a chance to properly dissect it?
For me, it's really nice to have an album which I have really enjoyed dissecting. Not to say that I haven't enjoyed some of the other albums, but they have been a little bit harder work just because fundamentally some of it grates with me, or I haven't felt as included as someone, you know, who haven't read those books and that kind of thing. And I've enjoyed bits of it sonically. It's been really well put together. There's been lots to talk around. And just from a thought exercise, I've enjoyed listening to them and going through them anyway. However, it is nice to be able to just say I like things and talk about why you like them. And this album, I've found that there's just been more of that, which has been great. One strange track notwithstanding, I feel like it's a 9 out of 10 album in that way, because there are 10 tracks and I think that 9 of them are very listen-toable. I listened to the album just before we started talking one more time to get it in my head. And when I sat down to talk to you, I just felt physically energized. It's a great album for that. It's an album which I will definitely be listening to just as a fun thing, which just goes into my rotation. I wasn't expecting something like this to come at the end, especially when things like Chronicle and that kind of thing made me think that they might have been veering in directions which I will watch them do, but won't run after them as enthusiastically. And this, as someone who's listened to, what is this, like 15, 16 albums now? This is some of the stuff that I was expecting or have just become more familiar with. So I think it's a great way to end the decade. There's so much quality, exuberance. It's great to have seen them come this far and really be able to put tracks together, sing well, play great, even though weird things still happen to them, like having 3 weeks to put things together and that kind of thing. You know, I feel like the universe is still having fun with them in some way. They're not plucky musicians anymore. You know, they are seasoned pros. And I feel like this really proves that. And it's great to not even have to think about their more humble beginnings and their whole, we were playing with the tune knob and not pressing keys because we didn't know how to press keys. Now they really know how to press keys, you know.
They press a lot of them
and it's great. So yeah, I think it's a really good album. I am really surprised that it didn't do so well when it first came out. I'll be really interested to know where it came in the rankings now that people have retrospectively looked at it. But yeah, my concluding thought is that I'm trying to figure out if it's the best album of the 80s. I don't know. I still think Levitation is great, but this one, I don't know whether or not it's just because I've been listening to it more recently, but I think Levitation was very different. Maybe this just has a little bit more consistency just in its sound and in its kind of power, where Levitation was still a little bit more all over the place. Not in a bad way, but just in a different way. This one feels like an album which I can play pretty much the whole way through and I'm swept along with it on its journey. And so I really enjoy that.
That's interesting that your comparison for it in terms of do I prefer this to or not was Levitation, because I actually thought you were going to say it's interesting when I compare it to Choose Your Masks. I thought Choose Your Masks was your previous placeholder as your favorite 80s album, but I've obviously got that slightly wrong. It's definitely a less even record, Choose Your Masks. There are soaring moments on Choose Your Masks, and there are some other ones. You said when you started talking about The War I Survived, that you put it on and then you had to stop listening to it because you were so full of Black Sword and you needed a palate cleanse, really. You needed a gap. And I think when I mentioned that when I bought it, I'd been heavily into Black Sword and was into some of the Kerrang-like trappings of the time, that I didn't resonate with Xenon Codex as much. I didn't dislike it and I played it a lot because I had it and it was new. But it wasn't one that ended up in the rotation. It's not one I've gone back to. But it will be now. And it was quite soon into playing it again that I realized that was the case. It was like, okay, now it's time to prepare for Xenon Codex, get the vinyl out, and then put the vinyl on and then play it. And it was like, you know what? This is an easy listen. I'd said, I think one of my first messages to you was, this is a really easy listen. And that wasn't like in it's easy listening. It's just that it's very consistent. Whereas I think almost a staple of Hawkwind albums for me is that there are moments of soaring brilliance on them. And there are moments that you really have to grit your teeth through. And they're on the same record. But that's something I love about Hawkwind, the fact that they are so incredibly different. The albums can be roller coasters. I've found it to be an unusual experience to put a Hawkwind album on and to feel my mood being relatively consistent all the way through it. But in that way, I don't feel that there is, with the possible exception of Sword of the East, a track on here that I go, yeah, but wait for this track, but wait for this track. The whole thing kind of works together. That's why, to me, it's an easy listening, because I'm not waiting for two tracks to go by so I can get to track X. The whole thing just works. And I hadn't remembered that. So definitely now, with the things I've listened to in the years between now and then, and the albums that we've been listening to as part of Hawk Binge and everything else, Xenon Codex will definitely get played after we've put this podcast to bed. And that's kind of, for me, almost the acid test of how I come back to these albums. There are albums I'm perfectly happy with and think, what a good album that was. But it probably won't end up coming back around into the rotation. And then there are those that really do and will, and this will be one of them. So that is fun. So let's find out where this ranks. We use, as ever, Elric Newby's book, Hawkwind Fans Worldwide Facebook Top 40 Albums, which is definitely a snapshot in time and audience coming from one Facebook group, but it's quite a large Facebook group. The numbers of people are resonant enough. We know that opinions will differ across media and all the rest of it. But as a litmus test, it's quite an enjoyable one, if nothing else. Chronicle of the Black Sword ended up number 10, net 9, if you take out the live album. The Xenon Codex ends up at number 26. which is kind of sandwiched between Sonic Attack, which is one place behind it, and Choose Your Masks, which is a couple of paces ahead. Remember how surprised we were when those three RCA albums were very low down and yet seemed to be quite well loved. If you take all the live albums and compilations out of that list, I think you end up with Xenon Codex being 19th. I may have missed one or two, but it's in that lower teens vicinity, which is quite low down, which does, I think, reflect the huge shadow cast upon it by Chronicle of the Black Sword. The fact that they hadn't released anything into the wild in that 3 years. I think you do lose touch with the mainstream record buying crowd if you're not releasing new things. Things are moving very fast, and in the 3 years without Hawkwind releasing any new music, the world has just moved on and they've got to catch up again. But the fact that it ended up where it did with Hawkwind fandom, I can only hope that the people who listen to this, some of whom I know are excited about us doing this episode, so there are people out there who love the album anyway. But if we're now speaking to some people who haven't heard it for a long time or don't remember it that fondly or who loved Black Sword and were a bit meh on this one, hopefully maybe it'll come in for a little bit of re-evaluation, because I do think it deserves it. And certainly it'll be played on this listener's turntable again, probably this evening. Matt, the time has come. The track to go into the Hawk Binge Master Playlist.
It almost got down to the point where I flipped a coin between what went into Master and what went into Sessions, just because they were so close, and I'd listen to it and think, oh, I've got it right, and I'd listen to it again and thinking, oh, I've got it wrong. But after talking about it now and spending a fair few hours on this with you, I have decided that we will finish the 80s by putting The War I Survived into the Master Playlist. It's a lot of great energy. It's an interesting idea. It's very complex if you sit down and think about it. It's probably the most thinky track if you want to really take one away and try and figure out what does all this mean. And any track that reminds me that the Slaughterhouse-Five exists is going to get a big thumbs up in general from me. Also, it's the track which isn't so 80s-ish. It feels like it's just Hawkwind in a pure form, again, in its most intact, without having to kowtow to the sound of the time. I think it's really nicely delivered. It's got all the things which I look for in that style of Hawkwind track, and they do it really well. So yeah, I think with confidence that is the one that I want to put in. War I Survived.
Great pick. So we come to not only the final pick of the 1980s, but also the final pick of the Hawkbinge Sessions Playlist Volume 5, which is slightly shorter, but it feels good, I think, ending Volume 5 of the Sessions Playlist at the end of the decade, at the end of the series. What will join The War I Survived on the playlist?
I think it's going to be a surprise to no one that it's Sword of the East. As I talked about before, it's a track which clearly is a hit with a lot of people and is also a hit with me. I think it's really nicely arranged. I think it's smart. I think it's well delivered. It could almost be a spiritual successor to Silver Machine. I think the only reason that it slips down to Sessions playlist is that it's very 80s. And therefore, for me, it still has a tiny tarnish to it. And I like The War I Survived for just still having a little bit of that rawness. However, as a counterpoint to War I Survived, this being so polished, so nicely put together, and hearing all of Hawkwind singing in tune and changing key for the chorus is just immensely satisfying. So I think that definitely deserves to get documented.
An excellent suggestion and an excellent way to end the album, the podcast, the decade, the series. There are a couple of fun things coming. We will be doing a 1980s wrap-up episode to end season two. There's some more fun stuff happening. We can announce, I think, Matt, you are coming to the Hawkwind headlining of Prognosis. Is that correct?
That's a good reminder that I need to book my ticket. But yes, I've taken the time off work. It's going to be cool to see you and Hawkwind and maybe meet some people if people are going.
Yes, indeed. It's Indigo at the O2, where we actually saw Porcupine Tree all those years ago. And there are some good places around there. So if Matt does indeed make it, he has a ticket to the gig. So it's just about doing the flights now. But should that happen, then we would love to find a bar in the O2 and do a bit of a Hawk binge get together with you all. And so hopefully you won't beat us up for Matt's dislike of Assault and Battery.
If I get assaulted and battered for my dislike of Assault and Battery, then I'm going to charge people with crimes against irony.
And on that note, we will be back to wrap up the decade. And then at some point in the not too distant future, we will re-emerge in the bright lights of the 1990s. Until then, good evening.
You've been listening to Hawk Binge. It was devised and presented by Andy Hood and Matt Longstaff. The soundtrack was produced by Don Music Presents. To contact the show, drop us a message on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter by searching at HawkBinge, or send an email to podcast@hawkbinge.space. HawkBinge is part of the Deep Dive Podcast Network. To find more great band-focused podcasts like this one, head to @deepdivepodnet on Twitter and dive in. Thank you as always for listening. We'll see you next time. Ha 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 ha!